Businesses will come to order. First bill we'll be considering this evening is Senate File 565. Before we begin, however, I'd just like to thank and welcome everybody who's here to testify. And as you can see from our agenda, we have a considerable number of bills we're going to try to get through in a reasonable amount of time this evening. We have added some bills to the agenda that we are trying to accommodate, we are also going to end tonight at a reasonable period of time. We're not going to be here till midnight, so we'll do the best we can to get through the list. If something looks as though it's going to need more attention, more discussion than we have time to give it, we may have to end up laying it over, and it might or might not be that we'll have an opportunity to get back to it. So I just want to say that to make sure that, again, we want to be fair to everyone, but if it's important to you that your bill gets heard, please try to be brief and to the point. Thank you very much. Senator Moi, Senate File 565.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. We had an opportunity to discuss Senate File 565 the last time we had a data practice subcommittee meeting. Today, I would like to add to Senate File 565 the A3 amendment. The A3 amendment actually is Senator Pappas's, the data provisions from Senator Pappas's bill, Senate File 661. So though she's on the agenda, she will not be here tonight. And the reason why we are doing that is that actually Senate File 661 is not in the committee. We considered the Senate File 661 in the Judiciary Committee the other night, and we sent this file on to the Higher Ed Committee. But we gave her notice that we would retain the data practices provision and we would address it in the data practice subcommittee. She would like to ultimately include this language in the higher ed omnibus finance bill. So to make sure that any changes that we make in the subcommittee or in the Judiciary Committee gets to her committee, Madam Chair and members, I am going to make 565 the vehicle. So we're going to amend the data practices language from 661 to Senate File 565 and send both the provisions from 565 and the data provisions from 661 onto the Higher Ed Committee after we've processed both sets of language.
So on that motion, then, would it be your intent to put the two together and then to address the language?
Correct, Madam Chair. And since I can't recall, I don't think this is a committee engrossment. Is it, Ms. Pontius?
Madam Chair, Senator Moi, yeah, there's a committee engrossment, which is basically the delete everything amendment.
Oh, I see.
That was adopted last time. Okay. And then there's an A3, which is the exact language from Senate File 661.
Right.
So, and then, and then there's also, actually, there's an amendment that I did, which is an A4 to the A3, which
I haven't.
Is more technical. It just more specifically refers to the kinds of privacy laws that might be affected. Because what's being involved here is that the higher ed institutions are supposed to submit names and addresses of all their enrolled students to the Secretary of State. Under the educational data statute, some of that may or may not be public, depending on the school's policy on directory information, whether the individual student has opted out of having their directory information public. So rather than, I think the current language of the bill just refers to as permitted by applicable privacy laws, I thought it was preferable to specifically refer to the only one that would really be relevant.
And Madam Chair, members, I believe that's the crux of the reason why this section was brought to the data committee. So I moved the A4 amendment to the A3 amendment as an amendment to the A3 amendment.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Now, Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
On the A3 amendment, incorporate the Senator Pappas's former Senate File 661 to Senate File 565. So this is not to move the bill, but simply to put the two bills together. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
And the members, I know that we had a pretty robust discussion on Senate File 565. And Ms. Pontius, I think that the A4 Amendment addresses the concerns that were raised in 661. So unless members have any other questions, I'm ready to move the bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I'm trying to catch up to the speed of our proceedings here. The discussion we had the other day was regarding the University of Minnesota and its desire to make an exception, make themselves an exception of what their statute they're placed under, namely Chapter 13, the data privacy provisions.
Here's the rest.
That apply to almost every other area of state government. The University of Minnesota was requesting an exception that certain details of their investing remain private, and that no one in the state of Minnesota would know that other than themselves and perhaps the Regent Board. They also discussed the possibility that, or tried to assure us, and I hope I'm characterizing this right, and I'm sure I'll be corrected if I'm in error, but they suggested that they had a contract that with the investment firm that they deal with that would establish the parameters of their investment. And be that as it may, that too was discovered that that too is a private document not available for the public to review either. And the question that I had was, why is the university seeking this? And perhaps we could review the logic behind where they're going. And I was hoping that maybe we could have that discussion.
Sir, would you, Senator Moi?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I appreciate you bringing us back to that conversation. So let me just very briefly try to respond to your question, and then my witness from the University of Minnesota is here, and maybe he could add more detail. I think that I, at the last meeting, I articulated that the University of Minnesota is a public institution and a very good one with lots of very professional and thoughtful people who work at the University of Minnesota. There's no intention to try to hide, to try to make secret certain actions or transactions. And in fact, the University of Minnesota, it is because the University of Minnesota is a public institution subject to freedom information request that its information would have to be divulged. The only reason why the University of Minnesota has been forced to seek this exception is because unless we are able to obtain this exception, we will lose an opportunity to participate in a joint venture opportunities during very tough economic times when we're cutting the university's budget. And so I understand the concerns have been raised, and yet on balancing the very limited exception that they're asking for against some of the potential outcomes or some of the potential gains that we could get, I guess I fall on the side of saying that I'm willing to give this very limited exception on the condition that, you know, we will continue to monitor. And in the future, as a creature of our state, if something should evolve where it somehow they're behaving in ways that are contrary to what our intention is, we can haul them back here and strip them of this exception. But I don't think that these uncertain times is the right time for us to make it so difficult for them that they're basically being barred from opportunities that could garner us some resources to help our university. So those are my comments on why I think this is important, and I'll let my witness from the University of Minnesota to answer maybe some of the more technical aspect of this.
Sir, would you identify yourself for the record?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Richard Fitzenreiter. I'm the Chief Financial Officer and Treasurer at the University of Minnesota. I do have a handout to help the committee and perhaps clarify as best I can. I know this is a complicated issue, but for the committee, exactly what we're asking for and how that relates to the question earlier about the contract as well. So if the senator just took my copies. I'll go through this as quick as I can, but this is really a picture of what we're asking for. And on the
sir,
yes,
sir,
Senator.
I'm just going to interrupt you for a second and say we've already looked at this and had it explained to us at our last hearing. And rather than repeating the same testimony, I'm just wondering if Senator Limmer has a specific question or something that you could respond to, just in the interest of not repeating the same testimony, and unless there's someone on the committee that feels they'd like to hear it.
Well, Madam Chair, whenever we talk about data privacy, it's always important for the public to have an opportunity to listen what we're talking about. For those that didn't hear the hearing a few days ago, they probably won't have a background of what we're talking about now if we limit discussion. So I think we should continue with the testimony.
Senator Limmer,
try and be brief.
I do not want to go through the same thing that we've heard. So, sir, if you could perhaps summarize this, what we don't want to do and aren't going to do today is just repeat time that we've already spent committee on. But if you could quickly summarize, and then if Senator Limmer has a particular question, I'm sure he'll let you know.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, on the right side of this chart, the private data that we're asking, the data we're asking to be private, you can see in the blue colored type on the first part, financial, business, or proprietary data, as well as down in the bottom of the chart, the legal name of the investment, et cetera, is identical language in this bill to the protections currently enjoyed by the State Board of Investment in Minnesota Statutes 11A.24, sub 6, clause C. What we're asking for is one additional small carve-out that in that section of the State Board of Investment is public data, and that is in the middle of this chart. The funded amount, the market value of the investment, the internal rate of return, and the age of investment in years. That's the only real substantive difference in our request from that enjoyed by the State Board of Investment. The reason the State Board of Investment does not have that exemption, it is currently public data with the State Board of Investment, is because they don't make these types of investments. They have the right to do it, but they don't do it. We do it, and that section, that additional exemption, we need in order to continue to make these investments. That's really the only difference, Madam Chair, and that's all I have really in response to any. I can answer any other questions.
And Mr. Fitzridden, could you remind us again, or Fitzenreiter, I should say, could you remind us again what percentage of the university's investments would be encompassed in within this request?
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the University of Minnesota Board of Regents has a policy on asset allocation, and that policy allows for what we're talking about in this bill, no more than 40% of the endowment to be in this category.
Thank you, sir. Senator Limmer, did you have?
Yes. Madam Chair, thank you. In listening to the description of the bill and the justification, I keep hearing it come back to the same original perspective, and that is the investment that currently is being sought to be some of the data to be sealed from public view is requested because it's such a good investment, therefore it's justified. The rate of returns in the past are so good that they should be sealed. I'm not sure if that's a logic that carries all the way through, but as I look at it, we're basically saying if the university makes a investment that's so lucrative that it's above and beyond the pale, seal up the records. And in particular, the records that are being sought to be sealed, funded amount, market value of investment, internal rate of return, and age of investment years. And I was trying to determine what factor do we have in the state government or across our investment strategies that would cause us to seal data like this from the public review. It's their money after all.
Senator Limmer and Senator Mwah may want to respond to this as well, but I think it would be a mischaracterization to say that we're sealing anything. We're not sealing data. What we would be doing is giving a private designation, and not because the private equity funds being as successful from the testimony, and I'm just summarizing what I understood, that these private equity funds are small funds that are very selective about who they allow to invest with them, and yet they are the most successful funds in terms of their rates of return. Because they don't have to disclose data, they won't allow us to invest with them if we make that private information, their private information, public. And so I don't think it's that we're sealing their information. Their information is already private, and they just won't let us participate unless we play by their rules, is basically how I'm understanding this. And so I just want to make sure, I'm not saying whether I agree or disagree with you by saying that. I just want to make sure that I think we're accurately characterizing the situation. Senator Mwah, did you want to?
Madam Chair, that's exactly what I was going to say. And Ms. Neumeister has been working very hard, and he has some comments he'd like to make. And then I think, at the end of the day, it's more discussion on this is really not going to elucidate anymore. I mean, you either are willing to give them this opportunity or not. And so we may just have to agree to disagree.
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, this is my first time testifying about this bill. There's not need to go into too much detail other than some highlights because there was a very thorough discussion at the last meeting. First of all, I gave you a handout, and what you have is basically my own version of how the investments would go at the University of Minnesota, a copy of the Texas law, which gives out more information and which covers the University of Texas. Secondly, you have two newspaper articles. One is called The Complexities of Venture Capital Disclosure that gets into some of the issues. And then secondly, a recent article in the Wall Street Journal talking about how the SEC is starting to take an active interest in private equity. And then thirdly, editorial from the St. Paul Pioneer Press, which again raises some questions as you debate this issue. I oppose this bill as is. I think it's important when we talk about 40%, we're talking about $400 million of the University of Minnesota's money. That's at least what I've been told. Some of the concerns I have been discussed to summarize ethical issues. How would that become apparent? The issue of the social accountability of how things should be funded. One of the things that I do see that at least on the item that they just passed out this evening, it says they're going to name who the general partners are or whatever, but I don't see that in the law. So if that is, because if you look at the language, at least the current language, the names of the people who are the partners of the venture capital or the limited partnership, at least under proposed law, would be non-public. So if that, and maybe that would be a good friendly amendment. If you look on the colored chart he gave you, it talks about names of general partners. And I think that would be the names of the general partners of the venture capital company or the LLC company that they're talking about.
Go ahead.
And just to wrap it up, also you'll see on there, what I also gave to you was a copy of 11A24. If you look on the back of page 2, you'll see what the Board of Investments currently does. Are they similar in approach? Yes. But they're a world of difference in terms of asking what's public, what should not be. One other item that, again, that could be for discussion of this particular company, if you see my handout of the LLCs, is that what is in the Board of Investment, they say, what is the classification? Now, I don't know if these companies, private equity companies, have classifications or not. Maybe that should also be public. There are some other things, and as this bill goes through, I've given you a law. California law is very similar to it. Some other states, which I have no problem in sharing that information if there's more discussion on, at least from any of these folks. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's been thorough discussion. You know the points. And so,
Mr. Neumeister, a question I have for you is whether the University of Texas or California or any other states or entities that have addressed this issue and have met the criteria of these private equity funds with the laws that they've passed so that they are going to be allowed to invest with them, or whether you could say that this level of protection, or I should say this level of privacy for this information is more than what would be necessary to allow the university to invest in these funds.
At least as much as I know as of today, and only, again, it's not current today, but University of Texas still holds to this law. Whether or not the private equity, I don't know. There could have been maybe a subset of language in there. University of Texas has a unique thing. They call themselves UMITGO, which is where they do their own investment. It's like a company itself, which is different than what the U does. In California, at least at this point, I don't know. That's where this is where a lot of these issues came about, because Sequoia, which has been mentioned in previous testimony, had a relationship, I believe, with one of the folks in California, and then they decided not to be part of California at that time. And I don't know the status of that at this point.
Mr. Fitzenreiter, do you think you could briefly shed some light on that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is an emerging issue nationwide. My colleagues at Michigan, California, and Virginia are wrestling with these same issues today.
Senator Moi, I've read the St. Paul Pioneer Press editorial, and we've spent a lot of time talking about this. And I'd just like to ask you whether you would consider a motion that would move this forward without recommendation. I think if we were to do that, it would, and I'll try to explain where I'm coming from there. It seems to me that there are good policy arguments that could be made on both sides of this issue, but what it really boils down to is, in the budget times that we have right now, the possible loss of tens of millions of dollars to the University of Minnesota would put a big hole in their budget when we don't have the money to make up that loss. And so I think if we sent it without recommendation, we would be signaling the reservations we have, but we would be ultimately allowing this to be a financial decision that would be more appropriately made in that committee, because there are a lot of decisions we are going to have to make this year simply for financial reasons that don't allow us to perhaps do everything we would like to do. And so
Madam Chair, and I will take your suggestion. I'm wondering, before we move the bill out, I'm wondering if it's possible for counsel to assist me so that I'm looking at the engrossment here. So that I put it on line 2.18 after the name of the, insert general partners and. So it will read the name of the general partners and then the. So it will be insert general partners and the legal entity in which the University of Minnesota has invested, so that it reflects the language that's in the chart that we passed out. I'd like to move that as an oral amendment to the bill.
On that amendment, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
And the manager, I'd like to move Senate File 565 without recommendation to the Committee on Higher Education.
Senator Limmer.
Judiciary. Sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I was having to look over Mr. Neumeister's documents, and I was kind of compelled by the Texas law that is in existence. It seems like they don't hesitate to use the name of the fund or the amount of money or the internal rate of return in their investments, and not to mention the names of the principals. And I don't know what the financial status is of the University of Texas, but I haven't heard that they're in serious default, but or if they've lost a great amount of money by investing in their funds. But it should be noted that the state of Texas has considered this so important that they actually put a finding in their law that Senator
Betzold. They're not good lawmakers in Texas, Senator Lemmer.
Well, yeah, they are a little different, aren't they? But if I could just read their basic philosophy. Under the fundamental philosophy of American government, it is the policy of this state that investments of government are investments of and for the people, and the people are entitled to information regarding those investments. I share that view. The other document that Mr. Neumeister presented was an article by the Wall Street Journal where the current administration in Washington, President Obama's administration, is also aiming for disclosure of private equity firms, and that Senate legislation would require firms to register with the SEC and release details on investors. And just a quick short line, the nation's private equity firms could be forced to register with the Security and Exchange Commission while also divulging the value of their funds and names of all investors in a new Senate bill titled the Hedge Fund Transparency Act. There seems to be a lot of interest, and I would say on both sides of the aisle, that investments of and for the people should be open. I oppose this bill because this bill seeks to have specific details on investments to be held private, meaning sealed from the public. And I'll currently keep working to try to amend it later on in the other committee, but I think we may be going in a little different direction. I hope that our quest for rate of return is not the only factor that forces us to keep these records so close to the vest that the public doesn't know what we're doing.
And Madam Chair,
Senator
Lemmer, that's just not true. I have to say that around here there's more gray than there is black and white. And I know that, I mean, you and I have done some good work together, and in this area it's just absolutely not true that the only rationale is the quest for the rate of return. In fact, this is a quest for an opportunity to be invited to the table, not guaranteeing that there will even be a rate of return. Minnesota has absolutely no joint ventures opportunities whatsoever. I mean, we just don't. We don't have those opportunities here in Minnesota. Maybe other states could afford to be more opportunistic and liberal in their ability to take advantage of the opportunities within their state. But Minnesota, we don't have the kind of financing opportunities we have it here. And we're dependent on others who are investing elsewhere. And to be uninvited to the table because we have really good laws in place doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to see if there's a way we could find an exception we could carve out to invite us to the table. It doesn't guarantee that we'll partake in any of the returns. We have to be first invited to the table. And what we're looking at here is an opportunity for that invitation. This is an emerging issue. And what is consistent for the state of Texas today, if we pass this law, I wouldn't be surprised that if this is an emerging issue, that a couple of years from now, some legislators at the Texas legislature will pull out the Minnesota law and say, hey, look what the state of Minnesota did in order to give their university access to these opportunities. So I know, Madam Chair, that we've taken up a lot of time, but I have to say that it is not as black and white. And there is a whole lot of gray, and that's why we're having these really good discussions about the issue. With that, Madam Chair, I renew my motion to send Senate File 565 without recommendation to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just going to make one final comment as well. I think we all here share the desire to have information as public as possible, and I don't think anyone has talked about that this committee any more than I have. I haven't made a decision because of what's been written about this issue, but I would say that even among those who are the greatest advocates for freedom of information, the press, I didn't see what I saw was a message to please be careful and deliberative about this process and not to do it lightly. And that was the reason for my suggestion, because I think these are serious financial times, and we're going to have to weigh some serious financial decisions, and I think we need to give some latitude to the people at the level making those decisions. So, yes.
Madam Chair, the virtue of the University of Minnesota with its current investment strategy may be a very good one. We necessarily wouldn't know except for some of the private talk of what their rate of returns may have been, and especially that was referenced in our last meeting. But sometime in the future, there may be a temptation to invest in something else that may not be of such a high character, and the public may never know. And that's why we have to be careful. We have to have this type of discussion, because we are setting the policy direction not for today and what the university is investing in today, but into the future, and we won't be able to know, and neither will our public.
On Senator Moore's motion that the bill be moved without recommendation, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Next bill, Senate file 1695, Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, as this subcommittee is well aware, last year, actually for the last 2 years, we've looked at the data harvesting issue, where business groups would collect government data, and then they would be using that for business purposes to spread them out. And particularly in this day of the Internet, people rely upon these business services and the data that's contained in to make very critical decisions about the people who are the subjects of the data. And we passed, as a matter of policy, the approval of that. But we haven't had a delayed effective date until this July 2009, because we, just like when we make any major decisions like that, sometimes we want to make sure that we've got it all right. We want to have an opportunity for people to review what we've done, and if give the legislature one more shot if there's any need to change things. The policy is still a good one. I've learned probably even more in the last year about this issue, again, having worked on it the previous 2 years. There are instances where these business organizations collect information. They just somehow get it wrong, and they put out the information wrong. And that does a disservice to the individuals, and these organizations have an affirmative duty to correct their information and put it out. It's very difficult once you send things out through the Internet to pull it back in. But we do want them to make the efforts to try to get it right. I'll give you one other example that came to my attention in meeting with some interested parties about this, where apparently there was an individual who committed some traffic offenses, and he gave not his correct name, but the name of a friend of his who happened to be a soldier deployed to Iraq. So the information that was correctly reported, written down, was wrong information. But it was exactly the information that the individual gave. He said, this is my name, even though he was lying. So when the business organizations collected that information, they took the information exactly as it appeared in the public records, and that's what went forward, except it was wrong. So you've got the information where the organizations have done everything correctly, except there's wrong information. So, again, you know, there's a strong interest in public policy in making sure that when we find out that there's wrong information going through the system being used by these business organizations, they get it correct. Now, as we get closer and closer to the effective date, and I introduced one bill earlier this session that was a concern of this area, and I've subsequently introduced Senate File 1695, but that was just quite recently, to be honest with you, in the last week or so. And I realize that there was a lot of individuals, you know, who want to, some individuals want to keep the law that we have on the books exactly as it is. Don't make any changes. It's perfect. Other groups would like to have the whole thing repealed. They'd like to go away. I don't think that's going to happen. I think that we've made our statement. We believe that there are some things that need to be done in this area, and we want to have it done. I do feel a responsibility to make sure that if it's on the books, we get it right, and that if there's any necessary changes that need to be made, we do that. Now, one of the problems we run into deadline week, of course, is that there's a lot of things going on. We have to be in a lot of places at many times, and as we've gotten closer and closer to this particular hearing, I've got more and more people coming to me on all sides of the issue. In fact, I see a number of names here tonight of people who want to testify on 1695 who, as far as I know, have not contacted my office or certainly haven't talked to me about what their concerns are. I would like to know what they are. I want to be respectful of this subcommittee's time because, you know, we want to get it done right. But I think as the author of the original bill, I would like to spend a little bit more time talking to individuals and people and see if there's some solutions that can be had. Maybe there are none. I don't know that. We got a choice. We can spend our time tonight, and there are people prepared to spend as much time tonight as they want to and talk as much as they want for whatever purpose, for whatever reason, either to kill my bill or to make sure no changes happen or whatever the agenda is. And I don't think that's a very good use of our subcommittee's time. So, Madam Chair, I have the A1 amendment to Senate File 1695. The A1 amendment is very simple. It extends the effective date of the current law to July 1st of 2010. It would go into effect July 1st of 2009. This extends it out for 1 year. Now, we still have time in this legislative session to fix the law as it is on the books, if it needs fixing. We've got time to discuss this. I would certainly like the opportunity to meet with the interested parties to discuss that. And it could very well be that we could make a decision later on this legislative session to just roll it back and have it go into effect July 1st of 2009, as is with changes. Or we might have it delay the effective date until 2010. But to be honest with you, Madam Chair and members, I think that if we go this route, this gives an incentive to everybody to let's sit down and talk about it because they don't necessarily know what my next move is going to be.
Madam Chair?
Senator Moi.
Senator Betzel, if the individuals involved in this discussion can't resolve it, this will go into effect, and there will not be another extension.
Madam Chair, we want the law to go into effect. We want it to get it right, though. So I do want the parties. I don't want any party to think they've somehow got the upper hand in this discussion. If there's changes that need to be made, let's make them. If there are no changes that need to be made, let's not. I don't think again it's a good way to spend the subcommittee's time for me to start listening to a lot of people testifying when I don't have any clue where they're coming from or what their testimony is. I'd like to know what it is before we circle back to the subcommittee. So that's what I'm trying to do at this moment, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Betzold. And Senator Betzold, I'm willing to support your amendment with the understanding or just, I guess, statement that because I spent a half an hour again out of the Judiciary Committee last night talking to the group who would like to basically, I'm sure, have this repealed about what they were considering technical changes or clarifications that I think were really more sounded to me like a desire to revisit decisions we already made last session, which I don't think we need to have that whole discussion again or that anyone has changed their mind since we heard this. But if there truly are some technical clarifications or things that then we should make every effort to make those accommodations. And so I guess I'm willing to go along with your amendment and support it, but my preference would be that we get something done that's going to go into effect this year, and I'd want to come back and take a look at doing that if it seems like either party isn't really negotiating in good faith here.
And, Madam Chair, that's my intention to have people negotiate, but the clock is running, and it is really to nobody's benefit to try to run out the clock.
Any further discussion? On Senator Betzold's amendment, then, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, that concludes my remarks tonight on Senate File 1695.
Senator Saltzman.
Included. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I am here with Senate File 863, and I believe I have an A5 amendment. And this, I believe, reflects the work that was done last time I was with you. And it's a pleasure to be back, by the way. I always hear chuckling when I.
This is in here now. So we're actually going to end the bills that are in the big amendment.
Members, just for everyone to be able to follow Senator Saltzman, we're now working off of the Article 1, which is in your packet, and is this one that's called the A2 amendment.
That's it? Madam Chair, members, yeah, that's the A2, which she had the little working document summary. And so Senator Saltzman's bill, as it was amended in the last committee hearing, is now Section 3 in Article 1 of this amendment.
And so the amendment that I, or any changes to this, would be to this document, just so we can all follow with you, Senator Saltzman. So you had an amendment for us to look at. Has that been distributed?
Well,
or do we have it?
Perhaps, Madam Chair, I have an amendment from Ms. Pontius, and is this... I don't need this amendment. I'm unclear. I'm sorry, but if you already have the amendment.
Madam Chair, Senator Saltzman, I think Ms. Breyer-Kopinski can kind of address it. It kind of narrows down the language of your bill, and it's basically the same language that's in the bill right now, but it doesn't deal with attorneys. I think the feeling being that you can always share information with your attorney, and you don't need data authorization for that. But it just deals with sharing data with insurance carriers.
Thank you. So perhaps you should testify on that, Madam
and
Chair.
Senator Saltzman, I'm sorry. Before we've got a housekeeping matter here, I think I made an error on Senator Betzold's bill.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would move the Senate File 1695 as amended be incorporated in the Omnibus Data Practices Bill, with the understanding it may change at some point.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Sorry, Senator Saltzman.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Lori Barkopensky. I'm with the Department of Administration, and I've been assisting Senator Saltzman with an amendment that narrows the focus of the language that you talked about last time you met. So this one would allow a government entity to share data with its insurance carrier, its insurance trust, as is needed to commence or defend against any proceeding involving one of their employees or their agents. It dramatically narrows it. So we just say, if I'm paying premiums for insurance, then I'm going to be able to share not public data with my insurance carrier should I need to. And it also includes the provisions that you talked about last time about making sure that when the insurance company has it, and if they're not a government entity, that they need to be able to follow the provisions of the Data Practices Act when they get this data.
Senator Saltzman, I don't see anything in this amendment about giving notice to the person that their information has been shared. Do we have a separate amendment related to that?
I do not, Madam Chair. I know that you had mentioned to me that you may be comfortable with just in terms of notice, there was some discussion of what that would mean, and that the notice may just be a response, just a letter back to the person who sent the original letter. It would not necessarily have to mean finding the person, but the person who had sent the letter. Are you comfortable with that?
Well, Senator Saltzman, I have an amendment here that I guess that Ms. Pontius drafted in anticipation of the issue that I raised last committee hearing. And this one is a little broader than that, but what the language would read, the government entity must, this is the A8 amendment, the government entity must notify the subject of the data of any data that are released under this section. And I guess I like that language. Senator Saltzman, do you have a
and perhaps a comment from my witness?
Madam Chair and members, one of the provisions of existing law is that when a government entity collects data about someone directly from that person, they are provided a Tennyson warning notice.
Could you state your name for the record?
Lori Byer-Kopensky, Department of Administration. One of the provisions of current law is that when the government collects data directly from a person, they receive what's known as a Tennyson warning, which provides them an opportunity to know how data is going to be used and who it's going to be shared with outside the entity. So there's already a notice when data is collected from someone, so this would be an additional notice on top of that.
Senator Moi?
Well, Ms. Barkowinski, though, isn't that an instance where you're giving kind of that general Tennyson warning when you're giving the information? But I think what we're doing here, though, is that if an incident arises which is unforeseen and this data is going to be shared, there's really no way of knowing when you sign or when you read that Tennyson warning at the front end that at some point in the future this information is going to be provided to the insurance carrier representative. So I think that it's okay to, when that does arise, to give the second notice. And I guess I'd like the A8 amendment. So, Madam Chair, if I'll move the A8 amendment.
Senator Moi has moved the A8 amendment to the A5 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Now that we passed the A8 amendment, if the subject of the data disagreed, can they halt the transfer of that data?
Senator Limmer, I guess I was thinking the same thing, and I was thinking about whether we should have some language in here, or maybe I would ask Mr. Pontius if this would be an automatic anyway, but something like subject to the subject's, I'm thinking of, you know, their opportunity to seek a court order preventing the release of the information or something like that. I mean, that's a pretty heavy burden to have to carry to get a court order, but it does seem like there should be some recourse that would allow them to prevent the release of this information. Ms. Pontius, could you tell us what the law would provide?
I think the way it's drafted, this is not going to be a notice they're going to get before it's released. They're just going to be told that it's released.
Yeah.
Well, Madam Chair, should we at least consider that the government is prospectively seeking this data and that the subject of the data must learn of this request ahead of the release?
Senator Limmer, that was kind of the direction I was thinking about when we talked about this before, that there should be some opportunity to object, sort of like in a normal situation where you have a request for discovery. In most cases, if you're involved in litigation and somebody wants some information, they make a discovery request, and you have an opportunity, if you don't think that there's that request for information is appropriate, to prevent it from being given. Senator Moi?
Madam Chair, are we not too much in the weeds on this? I mean, this is I want people to be notified that their information is being given, but isn't this a situation where they're being represented by these people? I mean, these are like their lawyers. So, I mean, this information is being given to the people who are representing them in a situation. And I'm all for saying to them, by the way, we've given you information, or we're giving you information to these people. But I'm wondering if we aren't creating more barriers than we think, like from a practical standpoint.
I'm sure.
1 minute, Senator Limmer. I just would like some clarification from Ms. Pontius, because one thing that was raised to me is, do we really need this, or do people already have that, or do government entities already have the right to share this information with their legal counsel? So perhaps for all of our sake, we could have Ms. Pontius clarify how this changes the law.
Madam Chair and members, well, first of all, with this amendment, it doesn't apply to legal counsel anymore, the assumption being that, in fact, you can share that data. You don't need a special law to do it. You know, I think an argument could be made that even with respect to your insurance carriers, the kind of relationship that you have with them, you could do this without a special law, and that this was probably more just actually to explicitly state it, that can be shared, because I know there had been concerns raised by some people that, well, we're not sure, especially when we're sharing with in one of these insurance pools or something where it's not a government entity that we're sharing it with, maybe we need some language making it clear that we can share this data.
Well,
and that's why it's in here. So this doesn't deal with attorneys at all now. It just deals with insurance carriers.
I know we have at least one person who would like to testify who's not in favor of the bill. If we could hear from that person, that might help us to make a decision. And then I think we will have, unless there's something else we haven't covered, we may just have to make a decision on vote on the bill. Is there someone who wants to testify in opposition to the bill?
For the record, my name is Rich Neumeister, and I only have 1 minute because I got to go upstairs to Almanac. The bottom line is, when I look at the language, Subdivision 1, which was adopted, that's still on the table under attorneys. If you took out the notwithstanding, but it allows any government entity may provide data that are not...
Mr. Neumeister, that's not in there anymore. We're working off the A5 amendment.
Delete that section.
Okay. I'm done.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Neumeister.
Thank you. Almanac awaits. Get good ratings.
Okay, so the A5 amendment then is essentially, is that a delay?
Madam Chairman, actually with this, because the Senator Saltzman's bill is now in that working document for the omnibus bill, this just deletes the section that's in the bill and replaces it with this language, or in the amendment.
Okay, so is there any more discussion with regard to this amendment? So then I believe the motion, does someone want to move the...
Madam Chair, I move that Section 3 as amended.
Just move the A5 amendment.
We have to move the A5 amendment.
Oh, I thought I moved that. But then, Madam Chair, I move the A5 amendment.
As amended. And that just puts in the bill.
On that... I repeat, Senator Betzel.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Is the A8
members?
Yes. Yes. That was the S amended portion.
Okay.
The amended.
Now, what do I do with
version?
My bill?
Senator Limmer, we're almost done.
I've got a whole bunch more to
unless
talk
you want
about.
To talk about this. Oh, wait. There's
their technical subject. Maybe save that for last.
Is everything else?
Okay. Senate File 1310 And we're going to skip over 863 since that's our vehicle, so we'll come back and deal with that last. And I think that's strictly a technical bill. Is there any, let me ask, is there anyone who, my understanding of Senate 863 is really just a technical bill, but was there anyone here in the audience who wanted to testify on that bill? And I think we'll move past that one, come back to it at the end, to Senate File 1310, which is Senator Scheid's bill that has to do with the data practices provisions in changes to the Minnesota No-Fault Act. And Senator Scheid had to leave earlier today, and so I told her that I would introduce her bill for her. I'm trying to find it in my papers.
Madam Chair, technically, Senator Scheid's bill is not in the committee. We just took the data provisions of that bill, and so it is in the committee by way of an article in our A2 amendment or our A2 document on page 15. And I believe that the rest of the other bills that's listed under that are all in this document. And the reason why we listed these bills is for notice purposes so that the public knows that the data provisions in these bills are going to be considered tonight. We thought that given the deadline, this would be the most expeditious way to move all the bills out by just bringing these provisions here. So,
The language provisions from Senator Scheid's bill are in then are the A2 amendment, and on page 16, beginning at the last line, 16.36, what this does is strikes the language, the commissioner may also furnish an electronic copy of the database of accident records which must not contain personal or private data on individuals to private agencies as provided in paragraph 6. For not less than the cost of preparing the copies of a bulk basis as provided in Section 1303, Subdivision 3. So essentially, there would be no new language. It eliminates that requirement for the Commissioner of Public Safety to have to perform that function. I know that, do we have anyone here to testify on behalf of the bill? Anyone from the department who would like to talk about the impact of this or the reason for the request? Or anyone, Mr. Johnson, did you want to testify? No? Okay, is there anyone here who wants to testify in opposition to this provision?
It's sort of redundant.
No one wants to testify at all. Okay. Well, just let me say for the purposes of the members then, or just for adding a little clarity to the reason for this, I think there was, from my understanding from Senator Scheid, and we did hear this bill in Commerce, is that, and having talked to the people who might be requesting these accident records, that they are going to be able to obtain copies of these records by paper copy, just simply not by obtaining an electronic copy. And, so there was some question about why we would do that or not do that. But in fairness to Senator Scheid, I'm not going to make any offers, since she couldn't be here today, to make any changes to this language one way or the other. I just want to make sure that the members kind of have an opportunity to understand what this does and consider it. Is there any questions or discussion? Senator Moi?
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that there were some concerns about why we were striking this language. And since referring this provision to the committee, Senate Counsel has had an opportunity to speak with Senator Scheid and some of the attorneys who are working on behalf of her bill. And it turns out that this language being stricken is actually appropriate because it's redundant language. And so since this language is in her bill and her bill is moving separately, Madam Chair, I don't think that we need to carry this language in the bill, so I move to strike Section 5 from the A2.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Ortman.
You can just take it out.
Okay. Okay. Senator Ortman, I understand, is on her way up. And then, so in the meantime, we will move to Senate File 857, which is my bill, which is in the, on page 70?
That's Article 4.
Yep, we're looking at Article 4, Subdivision 5, talking about copies of health records. And again, I'll just very briefly summarize to say that the intent of this bill was to reduce the cost of obtaining medical records for a certain group of people who are charged a substantial amount of money to obtain copies of their medical records, and for their insurers when they're considering their claims, who also are similarly charged. I had an opportunity, I made a request to talk to, we heard from a number of stakeholders representing hospitals who were concerned about this provision and this change, and I did meet with them, and I appreciate the fact that they sat down and met with me just a little over a week ago. And I asked them to get back to me with their suggestions, because when we had that meeting, it seemed as though there was agreement with some of my concerns of things that were practices that at least some organizations were using that really didn't appear to be justifiable. And also some concerns that that, you know, there were ways that these records were being copied that were unnecessarily adding to costs. I think I heard some acknowledgement that technology has changed, and the cost, for at least from the mechanical standpoint of doing this, is certainly less than it was when the bill was enacted. All of that being said, I got a letter back at the beginning of this week, and I do appreciate the letter and that someone took the time to write it. But essentially what the letter said is, although we'll continue to work with you, we don't really want to make any changes, and we're going to lose lots and lots of jobs if your bill is enacted, which I don't really understand exactly that rationale. But and then another thing I would like to say is that we're going to be getting a lot of federal stimulus money, and we're also making an effort on the state's part to make sure that we make our records, our medical records, electronic. And I heard some statements that, for example, we can make copies of our records that are stored electronically by paper, but we don't have the capacity to make a copy electronically. And that just kind of boggles my mind and disturbs me that as we go forward through this process of making records electronic, that somehow that there isn't any kind of a motive to make sure that this continues to be a lucrative process in copying these records, because I do think we want to make them as efficiently available to the person who's the subject as possible. But because this is a complex issue, and having talked to my other talked to my other committee members, or a couple of them, I think we want to try to be fair. And so I'm going to move to delete Senate File 863 from the bill with the understanding...
Article 4 from the bill. You just deleted the whole bill.
Oh, sorry. It's 857 from the bill. With the understanding that I do intend to reintroduce a bill next year, and that I want to make sure that we have addressed this issue and intend to pursue this issue in the future. Senator Betzel?
Well, first, procedurally, Madam Chair, you don't need to reintroduce any bill because you've already got your bill introduced. It's sitting in the Judiciary Committee.
Okay.
And it's not going to move anywhere, so you can bring it up again next year without introducing a brand new bill, because it carries over into the next biennium. On this issue, I'm not quite sure that the way the bill you've got right now is the way it's going. And the reason why, as I talked about last time, is because because the nature of medical records, as you've indicated, are changing to electronics. But it's going to require changes, I think, in all the parties who deal with records to come up with a different way of doing it. The days where the attorney can just get his client to sign a release form and ship it off to the medical clinic and say, send me what you got, everything, because I want to see everything, and then they copy a three-ring binder and send it back, that isn't the best way to be doing things anymore. I mean, maybe the attorney still sits in the office and has the client sign a release form, but when that form shows up at the clinic and everything is on computerized records, that's running the very problems that you've identified, where they have to find a way to produce records that right now are maybe more voluminous and more costly to do it. I think it's going to require, I can see, just on a very simple level, the attorney or a paralegal or somebody actually going down to the clinic or going to the medical, where the medical records are on screen, and say, okay, this is what I want, give me this. And they can get, and it's going to require the clinics to, have that technology available. Maybe the day will come, and I've often said, when they can just show up with a flash drive and say, okay, here's the flash drive, download that information, and everybody's happy. But it's going to require everybody to do a different way of doing things. Now, I don't have all the answers. I certainly don't. This is going to require people, who have an interest in maintaining medical records, people who are getting medical records, people who are experienced in IT issues. All those kind of folks have to be part of coming up with whatever solution is here. I'm certainly interested in working with you and other parties over the interim, if need be, to try to come up with a solution to it. If we can't find a solution to it, then I think we can come up with something that people are just going to have to live with. And so I think there's a motive or incentive to have people to try to work something out. I would just assume the stakeholders work with us and try to find the best way to make this happen. Given the changing of technology, and things are going to be different 5 years from now than they are today, again, I think that you've highlighted an important issue. Maybe it's not quite ripe to move ahead with it yet, but there has to be a solution, and we do need to let people know that we are interested in finding one.
Sarah Limmer or Sarah Moy, would you like to add anything?
Madam Chair, ditto Sarah everything Moy? He said.
Okay.
There you go.
Sarah Limmer?
No.
Okay. And again, my interest is just making sure that a small group of people doesn't have to become the profit center to subsidize copying everyone else's records. And I think in a nutshell, that's what's happening now, and that's what I don't think is fair or should be continuing. I don't think I need to repeat what Senator Betzold said, and I look forward to working with the stakeholders to try to find a good solution here.
On the motion.
On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Motion prevails.
Motion prevails. Okay. Is Senator Ortman here now?
Yes.
Senator Ortman. Section Senate File 963. And we are in.
This is an article.
We're in Article 5,
Section 7.
Section 7. Senator Ortman, you have an A7 amendment. Is that an author's amendment? Or?
It's my technical.
Oh, I guess this is a technical amendment. So would you like to go ahead then and describe your bill?
Madam Chair, all the members here, I believe, were present when this bill passed the policy committee. It is a bill to support the Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board by giving them additional designated powers and putting together funds for an executive an executive director, and asking them to put together a set of policies and procedures for accepting complaints, and then also further studying the regionalization of crime labs and access to forensic services across the state. When we were in committee, several of the members wanted to make sure that this committee had an opportunity to review the data privacy provisions, which you have before you, and counsel, Attorney Pontius, was kind enough to prepare an amendment for consideration by this committee tonight, and that's the A7, and I would ask that one of the members move that amendment on my behalf.
I'll move the amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer moves the A7 amendment. All those in favor?
What? Ms. Pontius.
Oh, I'm sorry. Would you like to describe the amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, I just tried to draft it in more traditional data practices language. If you look at the bill right now, it's on page 18. Just refers to the current law refers to reports being available to the public, so it just adds on to that unless there's a finding of negligence or misconduct, but it doesn't actually classify the data like you normally would. So what the amendment does, it says that that it is private data, basically, or non-public data, unless there is a finding of negligence or misconduct. So I think it says the same thing, but it just more explicitly states what kind of data that it is. And then similar issue is with the next sentence in the bill. It says that it just says the complaint isn't available to the public, but it doesn't classify it. So this would just say that the complaint or report is private data or non-public data, rather than just saying it's not accessible, available to the public. And then the last sentence, I wasn't sure, it just says something about not superseding the privacy rights of employees acting within the scope of the public employment. I'm assuming this was intended to get at situations where there might be personnel data involved and that this would not override data that would otherwise be private under the personnel data statute. And so that's what that last sentence in the amendment is. It just says this paragraph does not affect the classification data on employees.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
This amendment fits perfectly with the intention of the board. The original bill wasn't drafted as elegantly as Ms. Pontius just drafted it, and I think that I'm certain, though, that the amendment fits with the intention of the board, and it certainly fits with my intention for the classification of this information.
Senator Bitzel.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, and from Senator Ortman, the language that we're adopting for the data practices bill would be adopted regardless of whatever happens to Senate File 963. Is that correct? I mean, we're proposing a change to the Data Practices Act, which is, I mean, it's helpful to have the language for Senator Ortman's bill, but Senator Ortman, if your bill, if 963 doesn't happen, well, because of the appropriation or whatever, this is still good policy to put into law? Is that what our proposal is? Okay. So, okay.
Madam Chair, okay. If I can answer that, I believe that the Forensic Laboratory Board will be accepting complaints regardless of whether they investigate and regardless of the outcome. So I do think that this does make good law. The board is currently in existence, and it is the proper repository for any kind of complaint. And so I think this makes perfect sense to send these separately. And I'm hopeful that even regardless of the money, we'll actually pass quite a bit of this bill separately.
Madam Chair, and I believe your bill was sent to the Finance Committee, so it's no longer within this committee's jurisdiction. Is that correct? So the opportunity to add this language to that bill is not here anymore, so this is the only opportunity to do it. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Moi, and then Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, I think that the reason why it's here, though, is Senator Ortman agreed to send these provisions here,
right?
Because if her bill was found to be negligible, right. do we strike this language from the bill, Senator Ortman, or still we left it in there with the understanding that you would amend whatever action gets taken in the subcommittee?
Senator Ortman?
Right. Madam Chair, I think what we can do is ask this be taken out in the Finance Committee so that the data privacy portion goes into the omnibus bill and passes regardless, and we'll just take this out in Finance.
Okay. Senator Limmer?
Are we on the amendment or the bill?
We're still on the amendment, Senator Limmer.
I'll hold.
So on the A7 amendment,
Are you moving it? Senator Limmer moved it.
Oh, Senator Limmer moves the A7 amendment. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. On the...
I think that's it.
We're done.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. And Senator Betzold, I always learn a little more about procedure every time I'm in the same room with you. Thank you.
There you go.
Dangerous. You're encouraging him.
Senator Betzold, Senate File 1207.
Okay, just a second here. 1207 is okay. One classification.
What is that?
Oh, this is the one.
This is the one.
Yes. Where are we at on this? Where is it?
Yeah, it's an article. It's two articles, actually. It's articles two and three.
Is it all of those? Members, what we're looking at are Articles 2 and 3 of the A2 Amendment.
Madam Chair, members, at our last meeting, we did present the bill to you. I went through it. We took some testimony on it. We took no action on it. This is a bill that came from the Department of Administration. It was intended to be their technical cleanup bill. There was some testimony, as you may remember, by Mr. Neumeister and Mr. Gemberling, and I think maybe others, on a few issues. And although we have included them into the basic bill, we do have an A4 amendment to address some of those concerns. And I have to grab my my committee engrossment here. While
here.
We look. Okay. So... The A4 amendment, in fact...
it is in the packets.
Members, the A4 amendment should be in your packets.
A4?
I don't have it.
Madam Chair, members, just to go through the A4 amendment, there was some concern that about having the...
Is this it?
The application had to for temporary classification had to indicate that if it's not granted, it would affect the public interest, health, safety, and so forth. Public interest is not current law. It does affect the health, safety, and welfare. There were some concerns about the public interests, and so that language being added into the statute. So we're just proposing to remove it. On page 7 of the engrossment, it deletes lines 10, 12, and 13. And reinstates the stricken language. And that deals with the issue of publishing the notice of the opinions on the website. We still would be following the rules, publishing. Ms. Byer-Krupinski, I deal with that particular issue here. So,
Madam Chair and some members, I'm Lori Byer-Krupinski with the Department of Administration. Mr. Neumeister highlighted a concern that we were going to no longer be publishing in the State Register, so we're going to reinstate the publication in the State Register. But to allow us to meet the State Register's publishing deadlines, we are going to move from 10 days to 15 days so that we can actually meet their deadlines.
Then on page 9 of the committee engrossment, line 5, see what's that. We still would like to have the issue I highlighted last time was the fact that the temporary classifications expire in June, and actually we have an issue with the other bill that I've got on tonight's agenda that a temporary classification was granted, it expires in June, but there's a recommendation to continue this as a permanent classification, but that doesn't go into effect until August 1st. So you'd have a gap between the time that the temporary classification expired and the new law goes into effect. So what we want to do is to be able to close the gap so that it would go into effect on August 1st. Now, We want to just delete the language having it submitted to the legislature, just keep current law following its submission to the legislature. That's fine to just keep it there. On page 10, line 21, 22, this deals with the written reprimand, and again, the first full sentence there. Well, I'll let Ms. Byer-Krupinski again deal with this particular response, and again, responding to issues from last time. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, Mr. Neumeister.
Byer-Krupinski?
Yes. Last time, Mr. Neumeister and others highlighted the definition that was included of discipline, that was troubling, so we are going to remove that definition of discipline and just leave in the language that addresses the Court of Appeals case that we had discussed last time that said even though an employee was completely exonerated, that was still discipline. So we leave in the crucial part but get rid of the definition that was problematic for a number of folks.
So, Madam Chair, this doesn't deal with all the issues that were raised last time. It does deal with some of them, so I would move the A4 amendment.
Any discussion, members? On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
And, Madam Chair, I think there may be some people who want to express some concerns about some of the things that are still in there, and I will call your attention, and I have to find it, but the language dealing with public data on employer-paid remuneration, that is still within the bill that you have before you. And that was the issue of if somebody is being paid by a public entity, obviously that information is public. However, if an individual is working for a public entity and also works for other non-public entities, it doesn't mean that the non-public compensation becomes public. I gave my own example. As I said, you know, I do work for the Minnesota legislature. That's public information. I do work some work that I'm paid for by Hennepin County. That's public information. Now, there's no one place you can go to find that information. You'd have to go to Hennepin County to find that information. You'd have to go to the state senate to find the other information. But I also happen to do some work as a private attorney. The fact that I happen to be drawing pay from some of my public jobs doesn't mean my non-public pay is public information. There are some more prominent examples, and the one I gave you last time was the University of Minnesota basketball coach. He is being paid by public dollars. All his public pay is public information, to the extent that he may have some contracts that are authorized by the University of Minnesota to do some other outside work. That doesn't necessarily mean that information is public. Now, that can be controversial with high-profile figures, but that is the intent of this. The other part dealing with that same section talks about employer-provided email addresses, and you had some conflicting testimony last time about that. If an employer a public employer provides an email address, it ought to be public information because it is a government entity that is providing it. There are some concerns, and I believe that there's going to be some people testifying tonight with concerns about that, saying that it might be a cost to the local governments if they have to then provide a complete list somewhere of all email addresses of all public employees who happen to work for that entity. I don't know that this requires that be done. It just says that employer-provided email addresses is public information. We did have some concerns last time about if public employees' email addresses are made public, if their email address, they're going to get a lot of spam. I think that any legislator can respond to that easily. Our emails are public. I get a lot of unwanted emails. I get offers to invest in Nigerian stuff. I get all kinds of things that come on in. And frankly, I mean, I deal with it. I mean, I'm able to kind of just delete it as it comes in. I imagine maybe the governor of the state probably gets far or more emails than any of us get. So, but they've probably got staff to do it. I can't imagine that there's many government employees that are going to get anywhere near the level of emails that we get. And I think our email is manageable. Now, it may change down the road, but I don't see any reason why if it's a government email, it shouldn't be public information. But that's in a nutshell, again, refreshing your memories about some of the things we talked about last time. And as I say, if others have some concerns that have not been addressed, maybe they can remind us of what those concerns still are.
Senator Limmer, and while Senator Limmer is asking his question, I just would like to say that I have listed on our schedule that Mr. Neumeister and Mr. Michael Friedman would like to testify regarding this bill. Is there anyone else here who wants to testify? Okay. Could those who want to testify perhaps come up to the table while Senator Limmer is asking his question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Betzold, I wanted to bring our attention to page 9, line 27. That's on the employer paid addition.
Yeah, let me grab my copy.
Page 9, line 27, Senator Betzold. That was on the employer paid reference that was added to the bill.
Right.
Could you go over again the justification of defining it that way? I see that if that was not included, it would just cover any amount of added remuneration would have to be disclosed. And why wouldn't we keep that in?
And again, I'd have if Ms. Byer-Kropinski wants to respond to that. But again, it's my understanding they've had requests at the Department of Administration to clarify that issue. When you get an employee, and it's going to be usually a high level employee, as I said, the University of Minnesota basketball coach comes to mind, where there's a request to get all information from all sources of compensation. The governor of the state of Minnesota, the previous governor, Governor Ventura, was involved in a number of activities that were in the private sector. He was an announcer, you know, for a football league. There was discussion and questions at that time as to whether or not he should be disclosing that information. Now, obviously, that's one extreme. It's the governor of the state. But as you go down the list, there's going to be I don't know how you would frame a rule that's going to be all-encompassing for all things unless you identify what it is. And the fact, again, that you may have an employee, it could be a police officer, who is also moonlighting with authorization from his employer, saying that, you know, you're allowed to go out and work a second job, you know, as a guard at a bar or whatever, on the weekends. I guess the question that arises is, should the outside compensation be public data? And clearly what you earn in your capacity, in your role as a public official, public employee, is public. But how far do we go in saying that the compensation that a public employee receives outside of that arena is public? And as I say, this would say that clearly the employer paid remuneration is public. But that's where it would be limited to.
Senator Betzold, okay. I just have to say my preference is it seems to me that I can understand the argument that if you have something that's totally private, mm-hmm. and especially because we have people in public positions who aren't necessarily even working full-time, that shouldn't automatically open up all their private financial information. But I have a harder time making that case if a person's receiving more than one public salary, because then it seems to me like that should be more easily accessible. I know you said it's public information because if you go to both places you can get it, but if a person doesn't know that someone is drawing another public salary, they wouldn't necessarily get that information. And I just think that maybe there's a better case, you know, that the public might want to know, for example, if a person was drawing two full-time public salaries and wonder if they were getting their money's worth or something. So I just wonder if how you feel about that as far as whether there's a distinction between public funds that a person's receiving and private funds.
Well, Madam Chair, there's I don't know. This bill would not even propose to address the situation where somebody is working for numerous government entities. And this can happen with many professionals who are independent contractors. You may have some psychologists, as an example, that do work for the Social Security Administration. They also do work for the state of Minnesota. They independently contract out to go around to the counties, you know, throughout Minnesota to testify in various criminal law cases and so forth. Every place they go, they're being paid for by public funds. There's no one place you could possibly go that's going to pull it all together. But individually, every time that you get a public paycheck from whatever source, it ought to be public. And so, you know, if the issue is how do you find out that somebody is being paid from multiple sources in public, I don't know how you would do that today. This bill would not change any of that. But to the extent that it's public dollars, it ought to be public, and that's my point.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Limmer?
Thank you. Senator Betzold, the way the law is today, mm-hmm. Does one have to, let's say an elected official, do they have to reveal their income outside of their official capacities as the elected official?
Just at the government.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer.
Senator Betz.
You know, as I recall, I mean, we do have, for elected officials, we are required to disclose certain information that is on file with the Campaign Finance Disclosure Board. As an example, if you have any, if you own any real estate, if you are, you know, generally your sources of employment, you know, or income, you know, not your tax returns, of course, property holdings that you have. I mean, that, you know, there's a law in Minnesota that requires that you have to disclose that if you are going to be an elected official, at least a state elected official. I'm not sure about city council or county officials. I'm not aware of, you know, anything that requires public officials to disclose, for instance, their tax returns. That's not public information. Obviously, if somebody chooses to do that voluntarily, they may. But I'm not aware of anything that requires, you know, any of your privately earned pay to be disclosed just because you happen to be an employee or an elected official.
Right. Would the witness please identify yourself for the record, or whoever is going to go first?
For the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I'd like to thank Senator Betzold and the Department of Administration for addressing some of the concerns. The remuneration, I think it's very – remuneration is very important. If you look at the definition of remuneration, it's not just compensation. It can also be, you know, something got from something. Up until the opinion that was done by the university, information, I would say in general, if a question was asked – does the government entity have data that relates to an employee's or a director's information about some type of remuneration that was public? Now, you've got to remember a lot of, like police, for example, and that's the example I was going to use. The police are asked to be told, to tell the department how much they're getting, where they're going, you know, getting their overtime. Now, because the department has that, if someone asked for that, that would be public in the past, in general. But now with this opinion that was done by the commissioner, it basically, and that's what this proposed law is doing, is implementing that opinion that would no longer be available. So the citizen would not be able to know, you know, what the police officers that they're paying, you know, what they're doing outside, and what they're doing outside affecting the ability of law enforcement to do an effective job. What I'm just trying to say here is that there's not going to be any new information gotten. It's only going to be that information that the public entity or the department or whoever ask for that as part of their condition of that job. One example I'm sharing with you is in the police situation over time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Mr. Is it Friedman?
Yes. My name is Michael Friedman. I live in Minneapolis, and I wish I could
advocate 10% as much as Mr. Neumeister does. I happen to be testifying in this bill somewhat by accident because I was here for Senator Betzolt's other bill and realized when I saw this on the agenda, I saw that I have something I think is important to say about this one. I am here because I chaired the Civilian Review Authority in Minneapolis for 3 years between 2003 and 2006. And that's an agency that has a mission of promoting good policing and also accountable policing. And the issue of 13.43 in data personnel issues is one that we dealt with on a frequent basis and came up a lot in our public forums. I wrote an article about some of the reasons 13.43 is an obstacle to the goal of accountable policing that was published in the Hennepin Lawyer a couple years ago. The basic issue of 13.43, and this affects all government and not just policing, is that it actually gives a contrary incentive to accountability. Because if an incident of an employee is embarrassing to the government agency and the manager of that government agency, they have the incentive not to discipline the employee so as not to create public attention on the incident. It won't hit the newspapers that way. Now, I saw this very directly in one. I'll just speak very vaguely about one case I reviewed, and I have to speak vaguely because it's private data. But we did. I did sit on an evidence review of one case where someone complained about an officer, in which the officer's testimony was basically that everything the complainant said didn't happen. Nothing happened at all, and the complaint involved a wound, and it involved the use of a sexual toy that was taken from the premises from a female relative of the complainant and used in somewhat of a torturing fashion. There were multiple witnesses. There were medical records. The evidence was pretty overwhelming, and the police chief, as the authority of discipline, chose not to discipline it. And from a practical standpoint, I could see why, because there's disincentive. It would bring a lot of shame on the department. It would be in the newspapers for a few days. Now, I realize that this is a cleanup bill, and you're in your last week of policy discussion, and it's probably not the time to be rewriting 13.43. But I wanted to take this opportunity to testify and to make to urge those of you who are interested in more open and accountable government for looking at this issue in the upcoming legislative session, and I would personally be glad to work with you on that, and I know there are other people in the room who also have that kind of expertise. Thank you. I realize there are employee rights that need to be balanced too, and I think it's just a matter of creating a different balancing.
Thank you, Mr. Friedman. And while I appreciate your remarks, every one of the committee members here are open. You know, our doors are open to have the conversation, and we're interested in these issues. But we do have to try to make a point to make sure that the remarks from, you know, are relevant to the bills that we're considering, and on point to the, you know, the bills that are being introduced. So, okay. Just want to say that.
I'm sorry. I thought because it was 13.43 with some amended language, it was appropriate. Okay.
Well, I think we'd be very happy to visit with you, you know, and have that conversation with you. Okay. And so, would you state your name, please, for the record?
Certainly, Madam Chairman. My name is Don Gemberling, and I'm a citizen lobbyist who's tutoring under Rich Neumeister, being tutored by. I just have a few comments on the remaining language of Senator Betzold's bill. In the definition of personnel data, which I think, if I'm right, is we on page 9, 11? Yeah, page 9, line 11. Every once in a while, you find a case decided by the courts in which they put a tremendous emphasis on the verb you have chosen to use in defining a type of data. So, for example, if you look at the current language, it says you're getting rid of collected, and that's probably a good idea. You're replacing it with maintained. Is that the broadest possible term that you want to use? Because what you're really trying to do is you're trying to cover all personnel data. So what you may want to think about is inserting the word government in front of the word data on line 10. That brings in the existing definition of government data, which is about as broad as you can get to describe the fact that you're keeping information about someone. So that's one suggestion.
Madam Chair, let's do these one at a time here. I think that makes some sense.
Okay. Mr. Gemberling, then, is your suggestion mean that you would delete the word maintained, or would that...
No.
So you would just insert government data. And Mr. Or Senator Betzel, how do you feel about that
Madam
suggestion?
Madam Chair, I think that makes some sense. Again, the reason why we want to change from collected to maintained is because collected only applies to the data which the government collects, but other information could come into the hands of government that they get it. They didn't collect it, but they got it anyway, and it's personnel data. So I think that maintained is probably the better word here, but I think that if we say on page 9, line 10, after the word means, put the word government in there, that would more clarify the data we're talking about.
Senator Betzel moves on line 9.10 after the word means, insert the word government. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Betzel. Second point, on the issue of employee email addresses and some concern by local government that this may put some kind of cost on them. I can't tell you exactly when, but...
Mr. Gemberling, can you refer to the language?
Page 10, line 8.
Page 10, thank you, because I was having trouble finding it. Yeah, page 10, line 8. A number of years ago, it's got to be at least more than five, the Department of Administration issued an opinion that said employee email addresses are public. Okay? The opinion basically said if a work address is public... In the modern era, that usually means email addresses these days, that it seemed to us to make sense that email addresses ought to be public.
So, okay. Mr. Gemberling, basically you're saying you're in favor of that language.
Absolutely.
Okay, great.
I still am having a little trouble with employer provided because of some of the strange things that have happened in Washington, D.C., but I don't know if you can deal with that. Okay. I don't know if the Minnesota State Republican Committee is providing email facilities for state employees. I don't know that. I do know the governor says he never uses email. So, but that's another issue.
Madam Chair, let me just point, as I mentioned in my comments, I think that there may be some testimony from some local government individuals who are concerned that they think that that might be read to say that they would have to publish lists and make lists available. I don't see that this requires them to do that, but perhaps I may be reading in a different way they are. So,
Madam Chair, on the issue of remuneration,
page nine, line 9.27.
Yep. This only becomes an issue if the government entity has gotten data that one of its employees is being recompensed outside of the government entity by somebody else, okay? Give you an example. When I worked here, if I wanted to go practice law, which I could have done, not in a capacity dealing with my job, I could have done that. My employer would have never known that. There was no way that I had to report that. So you're only going to have a situation where there's an issue is if the employer knows you're getting recompensed. And Richard's example of cops is a very good example, okay? So I think from a policy perspective, you got to ask yourself if the position of the person being compensated is because, if the compensation that they're getting is because of the position they occupy within the government, and their employer thinks there's an interest and the employer getting that information, isn't there a public interest in getting that information? And the law enforcement example is a very good example. Some years ago, when my daughter was contemplating marriage, I learned that if you hold an event in the city of St. Paul, like a wedding, at some of the places in the city, like hotels, you have to hire cops as security guards. That's a city ordinance, okay? Now, I also know, and I know this is done in Minneapolis, I'm not sure of St. Paul, that to keep things in check, law enforcement gets reports on that from their employees. Well, you know, I think there's a public interest there in knowing that public employees are being compensated by people outside of the government for the work they do as a public employee. Okay? That's a policy thing you might want to think about and not necessarily deal with tonight because I know you got a lot on your plate, but that's something to think about because those law enforcement people and other people aren't getting jobs outside because they're nice people. It's because they occupy a position within the government. Lastly, one of the things that I react to, and I have to tell you it's probably emotional as I get older, are statements about how the Data Practices Act is too big, too convoluted, too confusing. Okay, I'm currently analyzing a report done by the Midwest Center for Democracy, and I've read about 5 pages now, and it's now said that 27 times. Okay. But part of the problem is when you have existing language that covers a situation, why add more language, more specific language, that says essentially the same thing? And the example I'm going to give you is, if you look on page 12, and we talked about this last time, lines 3 through 6, the Department of Administration is getting security plans or building security features for building plans to be classified specifically in the department is not public. There's an existing section in the Data Practices Act, section 1337, that contains a definition of security information that clearly covers building plans. Okay? If you look at the legislative history of that section, you'll discover that part of the reason why people wanted to have certain data classified as not public was because it was security features of buildings, the best example being the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis. If you go to Hennepin County or the city of Minneapolis and say, I want a copy of those plans, you know what they'll tell you? They'll tell you their security information and they're not public under 1337. Okay. So adding however many more words here to classify some data that's already classified just adds to this idea that the Data Practices Act is complex and confusing and too big.
Thank you, Mr. Kimberling. Senator Betzolder and Ms. Byer-Kambinski, do we need this language?
Madam Chair and members, Lori Byer-Kambinski, Department of Administration. One of the things about Section 1337 that Mr. Kimberling references is, yes, the government entity has the ability to protect these kinds of things with that section. You have then authorized very limited sharing outside the government when someone has decided that it's security information. And when that was only added just several years ago, and it has to be for, now I'm going to lose it, when the access will aid public health, promote public safety, or assist law enforcement. The kinds of needs that admin has to be able to share these plans don't fit that. That's a very high standard. Admin needs to be able to share it to build buildings, to get funding from you. We have a variety of reasons where we're going to need more flexibility about how we share these blueprints and with whom. And we didn't think that it would be appropriate to expand security information dissemination to include, you know, kind of anytime anyone wants to. We just thought that would be a larger policy decision that you would want to make at some later date.
Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Betzel, do you share this concern or of either one of the people at the table? Do you think that this is apparently a cross-reference, but without specific sites on it, and I don't know if it's exactly the same as found in Chapter 13, but do you think that at least we should make a site reference, or would it be better just taken out of the bill?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, first of all, I mean, it'd be kind of nice if we could reduce the whole Data Practice Act to one page or two pages and say, this is it. Now, basically, that's what the Federal Freedom of Information Act does. It's very short and very concise, but there's a lot of litigation going over it to try to figure out what it means. The legislature made its decision decades ago that we were going to, on a case-by-case basis, determine what is and what is not public information or how it's to be transferred, how it's to be used. I don't know that anybody can just, you know, understand the whole thing and keep it within Chapter 13. To the extent that issues come on up, and issues are coming on up, dealing with building designs and specifications, and frankly, if there's a feeling that, you know, that isn't, the current law isn't clear enough, we spend a lot of time around this place trying to clarify things so that we can make it clear, because the alternative is that right now under the Data Practice Act, it is public. And, you know, as an example, if somebody comes in with building plans for a new wing on the Minnesota Security Hospital, there's probably some information which we may not want to have as public information. I mean, how big it's going to be, that's fine, you know, and how many floors it's going to have. But there's other things that probably don't need to be public. So I think that to the extent that if there's a perceived, if it's vague, if we need some clarification, that's what we do a lot of time here, spend a lot of time doing.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wanted to testify on this bill? Would you please come to the table and identify yourself for the record?
Good evening, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ann Higgins. I work at the League of Minnesota Cities, and I want to thank Senator Betzold and Lori Beyer-Krupinski for their assistance in trying to craft these things. I'm generally in support of the things that you've just been talking about with regard to employer-added remuneration and the items on email addresses. I did want to speak just on behalf of someone who can't be here, Keith Carlson from the Minnesota Intercounty Association. The county association that he represents did have the concerns about the prospect that employer-provided and paid-for email addresses might be vulnerable to not just to spamming but to cyber attacks if in general they had to be released electronically in some manner by the counties. I don't see that language myself, and I've checked with our office. We think we're okay. We were approving of the language that's here in the bill now back some weeks ago, but I did want to relay their concern.
Thank you, Ms. Higgins. And, you know, between now and judiciary, if it's the desire of the committee to move this bill forward, I would just have to say that maybe there would be some comfort language we could add to say that requests for aggregate information, you know, we're going to be treated differently than individual requests for individual information. And also, I guess I thought that Mr. Gamberlin made a good point when he said that if the job requires that information be provided, because, you know, it seems like if there's a difference, if there's something about that public job that requires the employer to get that information, then perhaps it should be treated differently. And I'd like the opportunity to at least talk to Senator Betzold about that between now and judiciary.
Well, Madam Chair, if we're going to go back to that one, let me just offer a thought here. And we'll stick with the police officer example, because I think that's a fairly straightforward one. If a police department has a policy saying, okay, there's no moonlighting, you work this job and no other job, well, that's the policy. And if you violate that policy, you're fired. But if they say, you know, we don't mind if you want to hold a second job, we just want to know what you're doing. We want to know what hours you're working. For example, if you're going to be working at 6 a.m. Sunday morning, we don't want you working Saturday night, you know, till 2 in the morning. I mean, obviously. So I can see a police department saying, you know, we want the details if you're going to be holding a second job outside of this public job. And if for whatever reason they say, and we'd like to know what you're being paid in that position for whatever reason, maybe they're within their rights to demand that information so they know if there's any conflict of interest. We want to know who's paying you, for as an example. does that necessarily mean that that becomes public information? Because the alternative could very well be that maybe the police officers do not disclose the information, because if they think it's going to become public, why do it? I mean, it's one thing to report it to my employer, but if it's going to be public information, maybe I don't tell them. I don't want a license to lie here. Or maybe the police department might say, if we have to disclose that information publicly, maybe we won't ask for it. So at some point, you got to figure out where the line is here and figure out, you know, what are we trying to really get at? And if we're going to, maybe other areas of public service are different, but at least, you know, for the example I cited, I think there's a reason why the departments would want to know that information. It's just how much of it, you know, has to be public. Now, the fact that they are working a second job could very well be public. How much they're paying for it, I don't know.
Well, okay. And yeah. Senator Betzold, I'm sure you won't decline if we have another conversation. But
absolutely
rather
not.
Than spending more time on that, and I appreciate all of the efforts you've made to accommodate the interests of the people who've testified here and people who had concerns, are you ready to move your bill?
Well, I don't think I have to do anything because the language has already been incorporated into the committee draft. We've just amended the language, so I don't need to do anything further as far as
so
I know.
So far, Senator Betzold, we have been sort of adopting these piece by piece.
Okay.
And then when it comes to the last, because we haven't actually moved the bill yet, so
Do I need to move anything in 1207? I didn't amend 1207. I amended the committee engrossment. So
it's on the Articles 2 and 3.
So what you would be moving is Senate file Articles 2 and 3. Of
As amended.
As amended.
That would be my motion, Madam Chair.
Okay. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Okay.
Just move their bills.
That's okay. Many sections.
Senator Betzold, you have next Senate file 1247, Agricultural Research.
Madam Chair, this is a department bill from the Department of Agriculture, and this bill has already been heard in the Senate Agriculture and Veterans Committee yesterday. Here is the issue, and we do have somebody from the department here to also help explain the bill. The Department of Agriculture...
And Senator Betzold, sorry to interrupt you, but just so people can follow us, we're on page 14, Article 5. Sorry.
Yeah, thank you. The department does some research and monitoring of various agricultural facilities, land and so forth, to make sure that there aren't any environmental problems, there aren't any health problems and so forth. That's just part of their duties. However, in order to enter people's property, they have to have permission. You know, they don't have an absolute right to go on property and start collecting samples of things. And in order to facilitate getting, you know, doing the necessary research, monitoring that they're doing, they believe that they, you know, have to strike a balance here, a compromise, so that the people that are cooperating and providing the information that they're needing generally would be more cooperative if their names or addresses and phone numbers of the study participants were not public and the exact locations. However, the information that is gleaned by the department would be public, so that if there are some, for instance, if they come into contamination, some health issues, and so forth. That, in a nutshell, is what the bill. I'll turn it over to the department and let them describe it further.
Please state your name for the record.
Yes, Madam Chair. My name is Bob Patton. I'm with the Agricultural Development and Financial Assistance Division of the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. There are also other members of staff here in case there are some questions that go over my head. Thank you very much for having me here tonight. As Senator Betzold explained, we have a number of programs and projects in which we work cooperatively with landowners and farmers to go onto their land, to talk with them and collect data. And this, the purpose of of all these programs and projects that we're talking about in this bill are really non-regulatory. You have before you, I believe, a fact sheet from us that explains some of the types of programs and projects we work on. I'll just go over it as briefly as I can. I know it's getting late. There is the Farm Nutrient Management Assessment Program, or FANMAP. That's actually a set of interviews that are conducted, very detailed interviews that are conducted with farmers to find out what are they doing on their land, what kinds of fertilizer are they using, at what rates, what kind of tillage practices, and so forth. That information is extremely useful for the agency to be able to know what's occurring on the landscape, and therefore we can tailor our programs to better serve the public and really serve the environment, improve practices. We monitor pesticides in groundwater, and this is done in wells and springs that are often on private land, and look at trends. This is a relatively new program, the Livestock Environmental Quality Assurance Program, or LEQA. That is a program where trained people go onto the property, walk around a livestock farm, look at how housing is done, how manure management is done, and that provides us information, again, on what's happening on the landscape, also provides some useful information, feedback to the livestock producers. And then we conduct quite a few projects in research and development, research and demonstration projects. Again, we're working with private landowners cooperatively to do projects to perhaps test various ideas on best management practices, see how they work. In the real world, some of the things that we work on, we're working on right now, is testing, for example, winter rye as a cover crop to help prevent soil erosion. See how it actually works. If it's effective, we look at drainage practices, innovative. We call it conservation drainage. Some innovative drainage practices to result in better environmental outcomes and see how those work on the landscape. And we look at some managed grazing to again see how grazing can improve environmental outcomes of farming. In all these cases, they're for non-regulatory purposes, and we are really dependent on the good graces of the landowner to let them on our property, on their property, to talk with them, to find out, to be honest about what they're doing. Forthcoming is probably a better word. Forthcoming about what actually is going on the land, and we learn a lot of information that is in the public interest. With that, I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is there anyone, first of all, I guess, do the members have any questions for this witness? Then is there anyone else who wants to testify on this bill?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. Who is watching the watchers? To me, that's the question here. Several things about the bill. One of the things I asked the lobbyist for the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to come up with some answers with questions I had. I haven't really gotten full extent of the answers from the questions I had. I did get some meeting with the gentleman who is sitting across the table from me, the Department of Agriculture. One of the things I have concerns are is the high standard of substantive threat, the term of art. And so let's say, like, for example, I was involved a couple decades ago with the cancer surveillance thing that Representative Siegel was involved in with. Now, one of the things that has happened with the cancer surveillance, there are starting to see clusters, certain kinds of information,
Jennifer's
and then possibly sharing that information. That's one of the concerns I have, what may happen when they visit all these sites. Where does the Department of Agriculture make a decision to give out that information to the public, which I think is important? Secondly, the other item is that some of the research and monitoring that they do is with land also to see how polluted or how marked up the land is with various kinds of chemicals or kinds of various kinds of things like that that are done by the farming community. One of the other concerns I have is that if it gets into the aquifer or whatever, where the dust blows, you know, think chemicals that may be on the land and the wind blows into the other parts of communities, how will we know those kinds of things? So my point is substantial, and that maybe some other kinds of things can be made more generally public. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the few moments.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair, again, you know, if there's reason to believe that there's some contaminated land, I think that the Pollution Control Agency or the appropriate agencies can go do this. This is collecting voluntary information that right now the Department of Agriculture really doesn't have a right to demand be disclosed to them. This is all voluntary. And they're not going to get it voluntarily if, you know, if the subjects of the data refuse to do it because they're afraid that, you know, what they turn over is going to be made public. Again, if there really are health threats to the community, the laws right now allow the government to act and to do something. But you can't force people to cooperate in something that we don't regulate. And that's what this is getting to.
Any further discussions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Lummer.
Madam Chair, has there, Senator Betzel, has there been any input from the farming communities on this? Is the Farm Bureau or the National Farmers Organization in favor of this?
Yeah, Mr.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Senator Lummer, this bill, again, was heard yesterday in the Senate Agriculture and Veterans Committee. I don't recall, you know, they monitor that committee very closely. I don't recall any comments from them. We may have somebody here from the department to talk about that. So, yeah.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, I'm Quinn Cheney. I'm the policy director at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. And in developing this legislation, we did talk to all of the major agricultural groups from Farm Bureau, Farmers Union, and quite a variety of others. And no one really expressed any concern about the content of this bill.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, and one thing I'll have to advise Senator Olson about, the one thing that the Ag Committee made sure I was aware of is that there have been issues in recent years on pesticide information, and they were afraid, they were concerned that although they supported the language that you have before you, they did not want this to become a vehicle or to be expanded beyond the language that we have here. So, and but I had to explain that. I said, well, once it gets to the Judiciary Committee, it's going to be rolled into another bill that Senator Olson is carrying, but I wanted to make sure that she's aware of some concern from the Ag Committee.
Senator Betzel, Council has some advice for us on the language, starting at line 14.31. Ms. Pontius?
Yeah. Oh, Madam Chair, members, this is just the reference to releasing data with the written consent of the subject. That's the law, so you don't need to say it.
Okay. So I'll move to make that amendment, make that change.
On the motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. I'm sorry, I should restate it. So the language that would be stricken, was stricken with that motion, is the language starting on line 14.31, the Department of Ag may also disclose data with written consent of the subject data. So it would be lines 14.31, starting with the department, and all of 14.32.
It's just kind of...
So, any further discussion, Senator Betzel?
So I'll move. The language is already as amended within the committee in bill. Is that correct? I didn't bring it back. But
yes. So Senator Betzel moves.
I'll move to adopt it.
The language that's in the A2 amendment be adopted. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Senator.
Okay.
Senator Olson has a provision in the bill, but since she is occupied, we just looked at Article 2. Let's see, Article 5. She's here. Let's see.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. We're on 1441.
Sit back down.
Okay. Do you want to go present?
Yeah, I just need to wrap it up.
Okay.
Article 5, Sections 2 and 4.
Senate File 1341 can be found in the A2 Amendment in Article 5, Sections 2 and 4. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This has become a much shorter bill, or much shorter language than it started out when it was introduced. And I'll try to kind of briefly, and hopefully Mr. Meyer will correct me if I'm inaccurate in any of this description, but give the committee a little bit of a background description about how this data has been treated in the past. What the Senate File 1341 does is it addresses the handling of licensing data that is for the kinds of things that are within the jurisdiction of the Department of Natural Resources. So, for example, applications for game and fish licenses, ski passes, registering a recreational motor vehicle, and that type of thing. At one point, this information was treated publicly, and so people were able to get not only access to this information, but certain groups that might have had an interest in having aggregate lists of this information were getting those aggregate lists and using it for advertising or targeting them for whatever purposes. Apparently, about 3 years ago, the legislature made a decision to classify this information. And so it was classified so that no longer were people able to get aggregate information, but they could get information for a list of specific reasons that mirrored federal legislation. And there were, I think, like 14 exceptions for reasons that people could get the information. And a list of those exceptions from the original language of the bill, if somebody is interested, I have them. We had narrowed them down for our bill, I think, to 9 of the 14. But they basically included things like letting someone verify if someone wanted to repossess a vehicle, they could access this data to find out the latest address of where the vehicle had been registered, or if somebody wanted to do research, they could have access to this information, or if they were doing claims investigating activities, that type of thing. So we had a hearing in the Environmental Committee. And it was the only time, I guess, I've experienced where we've had a data practices issue that really seemed to generate an awful lot of interest. And we had a whole committee hearing doing what this committee normally does, talking about what information should be private or not private. And that committee decided, and I guess I have to say I wholeheartedly agree with what they did, that really we shouldn't have any of this information public outside of the exceptions that it would be still available within our government agencies for law enforcement purposes, or if the person specifically gives their consent to make the information available. But in all other cases, unless someone came forth between that committee and this committee and explained a really good reason why they needed to have access to this information, I think the thinking was that the public's expectation when they decide they want to go fishing and have to get a license or they have to register their boat or so forth is that the government would keep this information private. So that was the way the bill ended up coming out of the Environmental Committee. I guess I'll turn it over to Mr. Meyer because I know that he did do some research to find out what kinds of requests they've had for this information in the past from under the, when we did have those exceptions, and also to tell the committee whether anyone's contacted them with any concerns if we were to make the present bill more limiting than it has been in the past.
Mr. Meyer?
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. The bill before you today is one purely that we wanted to have a discussion with the legislature on the data that we collect through our electronic licensing system. Several years ago, as Senator Olson described, it was determined that our data that we collected was classified private under the United States Code Title 18 because of the connection with the driver's license number that we received. We linked our system to the Department of Public Safety's database, populated our fields. Therefore, our data was restricted under that. We are in the process of creating a new system, which will go online next March. So that's why the effective date of this provision is March 2010, which we will sever that tie. So at that time, all of the data we collect will become public. We wanted to make sure that this was done in an open fashion and communicated this change to the legislature so that we could have a discussion about whether this data should become public once again or should remain private. So that is the purpose of this bill. I had a conversation with Senator Olson. She wanted to introduce legislation that would maintain the status quo, so to speak. We went to the Environment Committee. They determined through some testimony or through presentation of the bill that we should remove some of those permissible uses of the data and restrict it just to what you see before you in the delete all amendment. Previously, I did have our staff query some data that we did have the requests for this information last year. In 2008, we processed 1,125 requests. 47% of those came from insurance companies for such work as claims investigations and worker compensation investigations, insurance and anti-fraud investigations, and proof of ownership or collection purposes. 19% of that number was for government entities such as the IRS and Department of Revenue for collection purposes, including back taxes, recreational vehicles confiscation, for example. Other state government entities to verify ownership of transferred recreational vehicles or watercraft, and Department of Human Services issues related to child support enforcement. 18% were from private investigators, usually working on the previously stated reasons. 12% were from financial institutions for debt collection purposes, and 4% were from towing companies. To date, I did contact several people who represented these entities since our first hearing and this hearing. I have not heard back from any concerns. That does not mean there aren't any out there. And this afternoon, we had a discussion with people from the Newspapers Association who do have some issues, and I believe they'll be testifying about the bill. But, Madam Chair, members, this is a discussion that we wanted to have in the open and with a lot of public recourse because the data privacy issues have changed so drastically since this data used to become public and since it has become private. We wanted to make sure that the legislature weighed in and gave us direction on how this data should be collected and maintained moving into the future.
Mr. Meyer, if this information were to go public again the way it previously was before the federal law kicked in, and people wanted to make an inquiry, do they pay you for the information, or how do you manage that?
Madam Chair, the individual inquiries would be managed through our department. The Department of Administration actually maintained these lists and sold these lists like any other list that was out there. So boat manufacturers, hunting and fishing guides, for example, would acquire this. People wanting a database for running campaigns, for example, our deer hunter list of 450,000 registered deer hunters was a very popular item back in the day for elected officials to purchase. So all of these lists were being sold to the public before the data was deemed private. And that's exactly why we're here, Madam Chair, so people understand what may occur in the future if we don't do this.
So if we adopt this language, we would say that the information may be disclosed for use by any government agency, including a law enforcement agency, in carrying out its functions, and for use by any requester with the written consent of the subject of the data. And that's it. No more, no selling, no none of that. will be going on. Mr. Meyer?
Madam Chair, there has not been any selling or any of that since 2006, I believe, when we restricted the data to specifically the 14 permissible uses through driver's license data. So you're absolutely correct. It actually will be more restrictive with this language change than it currently is in its form right now.
Thank you. I like this bill, Senator Olson. Senator Lamar?
Madam Chair, I may have a little different angle on it. Senator Olson, have you gotten any information from, let's say, the resort industry or manufacturers that might want to know who the snowmobile licensees are in the state of Minnesota, that type of thing?
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I haven't heard from anybody about this bill, which really kind of surprises me, considering that, if there were a great demand for this information, we had a public hearing about this, quite a lot of discussion. No one has contacted me. But, along the lines of what you said before about concerns about, I think we talked about respecting people's privacy, and that's generally the way that we go versus making sure that government information is public. This is information the government requires us to give. If we want to register a gun, if we want to get a hunting license, if we want to go fishing, we don't have a choice. We have to divulge this private information to the government. I think the expectation the public has is that that information will be honored and maintained and kept private and not used to be sold for profit or sold so that we can get a lot of mailings or sold so that we'll get political solicitations. That's my feeling. And that seemed to be the feeling of the unanimously in the Environment Committee. But that, of course, doesn't mean that this committee couldn't have a different feeling. That's just I'm very happy with the bill as it stands right now.
Madam Chair, I'm
Senator Lamar.
Simply trying to define in my mind, first the level for lack of a better term, the level of intensity of what this information would mean to someone, as opposed to perhaps medical records, whether someone knows I have a snowmobile trail sticker or not, versus whether they know I have cancer are two different things. And so I'm trying to determine the proportionality of absolute list protection. And so I don't know if we've ever had that discussion on that, but or is it all or nothing? Because if we do all or nothing, then I can bring a whole bunch of bills in here if everybody wants to close up every list in the state. And I don't know exactly what public purpose we're trying to achieve on this.
Well, Senator Lemmer, Mr. Myers just testified that we've not sold or disclosed any of this information since we linked up to the feds in 2006. And I don't know that any kind of harm has been done by that other than the inquiries that have been made appropriately so by governmental entities for governmental purposes, as stated by Mr. Meyer. So I think that so we're not trying to stand in the way of that. I think this is being consistent mm-hmm. with how we currently treat private data on citizens, is that for law enforcement purposes. But I think you would agree with me that part of the reason why we have all these data harvester bills that Senator Betzel has is that we're concerned about data that citizens give to government because they're trying to obtain a permit to do something that's required by government. And then somehow government is able to turn that around and sell it to private data harvester to be packaged in some way, whether that's for marketing purposes or other purposes. I think in the past we've commented that we would be cautious about that. And, in fact, this committee would have some concerns about that. So I think that actually this bill is pretty consistent with the direction that this subcommittee has been in our concerns about citizen data privacy. Senator Olson, I understand that you have an A3 amendment to tighten the language that's in Section 4 of the bill. Do you still intend to move that language?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move the A3 amendment. Basically, this is an amendment that tightens the language and I think was something that the department requested. What it does is it deletes everything on page 15, line 18, everything after the period, and inserts the language. The data may be disclosed for law enforcement purposes. The data other than the driver's license number may be disclosed to a government entity and for. And we needed to clarify that information about the driver's license number.
Okay.
I think that was right.
So, Senator Olson, your A3 amendment takes away the consent language. Mr. Meyer?
Madam Chair, members.
Ms. Pania says we don't need it because apparently that's current law. All right, the consent language. Senator Lemmer. On the A3 amendment, any further discussions? Senator Olson renews her motion to move the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Olson moves the inclusion of Section 2 and 4.
We did have a testifier.
Oh, testifiers. Chair. I apologize. Testifiers, please come on up.
Do you have that A3?
If you like the bill, you don't have to talk very long. If you hate it, you can tell us why.
Well, Madam Chair, members, Mark Anthonson, attorney for the Minnesota Newspaper Association, I am somewhere in between. And first of all, I speak with great reluctance critical of this bill because the author has been a stalwart champion of public access in the legislature during her time here, and it's much appreciated by us. I want to just clarify a little bit, and I'm going to be brief, notwithstanding my concerns about this bill. It's very important for the committee to understand that until 3 years ago, all of this data was routinely accessible by the public and had been so for decades. And I'm not aware of any concerns anyone ever expressed or any problems anyone ever had as a consequence of that access. I am aware of many good reasons that benefit the public for allowing access to this data, because if you look at the types of privileges that are conferred through the DNR, which include the authority to carry a loaded, high-powered rifle in public, and the ability to drive high-powered vehicles through public lands at high speeds, including that privilege accorded to minors. And if you think about the mayhem that occurs across this state every year under the domain of these licenses and these privileges, there's a strong public interest in some accountability with respect to this database. Now, if the change in the law 3 years ago had occurred for some policy reason, I might feel differently, but it didn't. It was a fluke solely prompted by the fact that DNR started obtaining from driver and vehicle services the data, which then became subject to the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, one of the most nefarious laws ever enacted by Congress and one that this committee's predecessors have spent way too much time trying to sort through. So it was the fluke of DNR using that particular dedicated database that caused the classification. It was never a policy decision, never a good policy reason. And I'm not going to take the committee's time to itemize lots and lots of examples of why public access, at least to some extent, to this database is important. I assure you there are many examples that could be cited, but the bigger picture that I think you need to understand, this would be historically measured one of the most sweeping changes in state data classification law ever undertaken. This is a huge public database. And I think before we move forward with this kind of unconditional and absolute reclassification, much more examination of the consequences should be undertaken. I do want to say this. We talked to the DNR people, Commissioner Meyer, a little while ago about this, and they were extremely and very gratifyingly receptive to conversations about this issue. As Mr. Meyer mentioned, they're not pushing ahead with this for a compelling specific reason. They think a conversation should occur, and we welcome that. But I don't think it has to be a hurried or quick conversation. Thank you.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I think the reason for the urgency here is that the DNR is about to do something that is going to make all this information public if we don't do something. And so this isn't some conversation that we can have without at our leisure without a consequence. And I would agree that this is a huge database, but I would submit that this is a huge government database containing a huge amount of what I would consider private information on individuals. And all the more reason why we have to be careful in protecting that information, because we always have to balance, you know, the Freedom of Information Act versus data privacy rules, making government information available and kind of erring on that side unless there's a good reason not to, but protecting private individual information unless there's a very good reason not to. And so that's where I distinguish, and I'm usually we're on the same page, but to me, this is private information that I don't think most people even were aware was being sold or even given out. I didn't know that, honestly, until I became involved in politics and found out that these lists had been used that way. I don't think most people even knew that the government could do that.
Mr. Gimberling?
Madam Chairman, Don Gimberling, just a couple of points. I was trying to think of a way to describe the DPPA in terms more hyperbolic than various. Unfortunately, the only things I can come up with are scatological, so that's not a good thing to do here. The linkage of this issue to the DPPA illustrates the dilemma I think you need to encounter. Similar information to that maintained by DNR, licensing information, under the bizarre terms of the DPPA, are available to 8 different types of organizations and businesses, with no consent by the data subject whatsoever. And that goes to the strange history of the DPPA, which we don't need to get into. So linking the decision that you want to make about DNR data to the DPPA ought to give you a little pause to think about it. Now, one of the things that Senator Olson is trying to do, and this is a good thing, is let's talk about this stuff. You know, I became concerned a while back that you didn't spend enough time talking about this stuff. And I'm still concerned, even though now when I come here, I don't get paid to sit here. But you think it through, because one of the things that's clearly facing us is a huge revenue problem. Mr. Amundson is absolutely correct. This stuff was sold for years. Okay, one of the better projects the Department of Administration did several years ago was the legislature asked us to do a study of licensing data and look at all of the revenue implications and that kind of thing. That study concluded with a strong recommendation that given the way licensing data was handled historically and the way it's handled in other states, that it ought to be a real good revenue source for the state of Minnesota. Now, that may be a bad idea. I don't know, but it's something you should think about. Now, let me suggest one possibility so you can put an urgency on this. One of the things you've done in the past when you wanted to think about something a little bit more, but you wanted to make sure that something happened, and you did something similar to this tonight, is you enact it, and you put a delayed effective date, okay? Then I think part of what's going to happen is you're going to start getting people coming out of the woodwork. You're going to get the boat manufacturers. You're going to get the snowmobile manufacturers or whoever represents them, because now they'll be back to saying, well, wait a minute, this isn't some trying to deal with a federal law that hardly anybody understands. This is now a state policy that we can affect.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I would just add that no one's come forward with any specific language related to a specific concern, but certainly if they did, there would be absolutely nothing preventing us from taking that up and amending the language. I would just suggest we should err on the side of keeping things private until someone has come with that language or that bill and offered a good reason and some specific language that would be narrowly crafted to address their concern.
Madam Chair, can I say one brief additional thing?
Yeah, you can't mention nefarious, though, Mr. Amphinson.
That's a word you don't use twice on the same evening, nice as it is. The issue of Minnesota business people using this data is a separate one. I think it's an intriguing one, and I'm willing to have a discussion anytime with someone that access to this kind of data, this kind of a targeted database, benefits not only the business owners, but the snowmobile operators and the hunters and the fishers as well, because they learn valuable information about commercial products they may not be aware of. But what I want to emphasize here is that's separate. That's a totally different hemisphere on this globe. My interest and my concern is that there's a huge public accountability component to having access to data about people who drive boats drunk and who go hunting and kill other people recklessly. And the public has an investment in monitoring the agency that issues those kinds of licenses. This is sort of private data, but you don't require people to get these licenses except for the fact that there's a strong public oversight need for this kind of behavior. And that, in turn, triggers a need for public accountability of the licensing agency. And I think the Star Tribune and the Pioneer Press always got the full database from the DNR before this unfortunate and capricious change occurred in 2006. Why did they do that? To sell things to them? No, because they could check up on people who were accused of bad behavior or who had engaged in bad behavior. And that's why I say let's not rush to judgment. There's a public accountability facet here that's very, very vital. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I would like to move the inclusion of the
Section 2.
Article 5, Sections 2 and 4.
Article 5, Sections 2 and 4.
Article 5, Section 2 and 4 in our...
For inclusion in the A2.
Inclusion in the A2 amendment.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, and the effective date being March 1st of 2010 is...
Because that's when the... Decoupling takes place.
That is.
Well,
thank you.
So. On Senator Olson's motion, all those any further discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to go. No, but you know. Well, we're getting down to the wire. We are now on Senate File 992. Senator Moy, I think, has our last two bills. And these are contained in sections...
Article 5, Section 3, Madam Chair.
Article 5, Section 3, for those who are following along.
Madam Chair, Article 5, Section 3 is a pretty short bill. It basically just says parole and county probation authorities may access data identifying Subdivision 2 on an applicant or permit holder who is also a defendant, parolee, or probationers of a district court. And I have a testifier here who's going to explain why we need this information.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Solheit. I'm current president of the Minnesota Corrections Association. It's a professional association, the oldest and largest in the state. It's made up of members of all three delivery systems, including probation, parole, supervised release agents, as well as correctional facility staff from both private, county, state facilities. The reason we're interested in seeing this, or our membership is interested in seeing this bill pass, is it does aid probation and parole agents in doing their job, a part of which is pre-sentence investigations, for which they would be providing this information back to the courts who, under certain situations, would be required to remove permits from persons who are convicted of certain crimes. The other interest we have in this is that for the safety of our own probation and parole officers, they are out in the community, and oftentimes they may be visiting homes of offenders, defendants maybe who are on pretrial supervision and the like, and for them to have access to this database will help assist them in preparing appropriately when they're conducting their business.
Sir, just could you explain to me which database we're talking about? The applicant or permit holder, that isn't the same database we were just talking about when it comes to permits for through the DNR. Which type of database are we talking about?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's the firearms data. It's all data pertaining to the purchase or transfer of firearms, applications for permits to carry firearms, which are collected by government entities. So it would be, I believe, BCA database on permit to purchase, permit to carry.
Okay. Is there anyone else who's here to testify with regard to this bill? Members, do you have any questions or discussion?
Madam Chair, is that written specifically enough to make the reader realize that it's for firearm data? I suppose it is in subdivision 2 on applicant
yes.
or permit.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
All right.
Yes. Madam Chair, if there's no further discussion, I move the inclusion of Section 3 and Article 5 to the A2 amendment.
All those in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the last file on the list is actually found in Article 5, Section 3 of the A2 amendment. And, Madam Chair, I have the A6 amendment to put the language in the shape I would like it to be in. And in the A6 amendment, I would like to incorporate the following.
Section 6. She said 3. Senator Moore, I think it's Section 6.
Yeah, Article 5, Section 6.
Okay.
And I'm moving the A6 amendment, and I'd like to incorporate into that. Do you all have the A6 amendment?
Yeah.
I'd like to incorporate into that this oral amendment.
Where is it?
I don't know if I have the A6.
I don't believe
it's
buried
in there.
Well, here's the language. It's, yeah.
Section 6.
This is the amendment to the bill, but this is the same language. Page 17.
Is this harassment?
Section 6. It's the same language.
Okay.
I have one.
We have the amendment now. Thank you.
Okay. On line 1.11, after threatened, I would like to insert oppressed, comma, persecuted, comma. I'd like to incorporate that into the A6 amendment, and I will explain. And that's that language now puts back into the A6 amendment the string of language that was in the original bill as introduced.
Okay. Senator Moore, would you like to give us some background?
Do you want to adopt the A6 amendment?
Oh, yes, we can adopt the A6 amendment.
It's an author's amendment.
Just to put this in the language or in the shape that you'd like to have it considered. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, members, Senator Limmer may remember that when we were in the Tax Committee, the tax policy and technical bill came to us, and this provision was in there. And because Senator Limmer and I raised some concerns about it, and in fact, it would have propelled that bill to come to the data to the Judiciary Committee and the Data Subcommittee. And so what I did was I asked Senate Counsel to take just that provision and drafted a separate bill, which I introduced. That bill then came to us. My hope is that as we address it, we will put it into the Omnibus Data Practices Bill, and then What I would like to do is I'd like to go back to tax committee and do an amendment to the current language that's in the tax bill to make sure that we have the right language in the tax bill. And we can either carry in the tax bill or carry in so we can either carry in the tax bill or carry in the omnibus data bill. But we can once we've dealt with it, we can have a discussion with the tax chain. We can either delete it from there or, you know, either way, I mean, but we can decide how we can we're going to deal with that. In any case, the reason why the Department of Revenue had this language drafted is that the current statute allows the department to let law enforcement know that a taxpayer has made threats of death or physical injury to a Department of Revenue employee or any other person. This proposal amends the statute to include situations where a taxpayer is harassing a department employee as a result of the employee carrying out their job duties. Sometimes such disclosure is necessary in order to prevent the situation from escalating into a more serious threat of death or physical injury. So the proposal authorizes the department to notify law enforcement when a taxpayer's harassment rises to the level of criminal harassment under Minnesota Statute Section 609749. And the language that's in the A6 Amendment that we just adopted, say for purposes of this subdivision harassment is, that restates the exact language in which harassment is defined in 609.749 Subdivision 1. So, in essence, the way that the amendment is, we've, and Senator Limmer, I think Senator Limmer and Senator Ortman talked about this, we've drafted this amendment so that the main elements of what constitute harassment under the criminal statute are incorporated, and then this proposal limits the information that can initially be disclosed to law enforcement to the name, address, and phone number of the harassing individual, the name of the employee being harassed, and the nature and circumstances of the harassment. And once law enforcement has been notified, it is then up to them to decide how best to proceed. And unless the situation is very serious, it is likely that they will simply contact the taxpayer first and warn the taxpayer to stop engaging in this type of conduct. But this is one way to give some protection. I think they've really narrowed the language. And in full disclosure, Madam Chair and members of the committee, the department was here, but we had a property tax subdivision committee meeting starting at 8 o'clock this morning. They were here all day. There was a conference committee that engaged the revenue staff all day today, and this bill was the last one on the agenda. And I told them that I will work with you all, and I will go back to them, but I asked them to go home because they were very tired, and they're not here, but I think we've tried to the best of our ability to narrow this language. So that's the bill.
Is there anyone here to testify on this bill? Do the members have any questions or discussion that they'd like to have regarding this bill? Senator Moi?
Madam Chair, then I move that article. No, I lost it. Section 6?
Article 5, Section 6, Madam Chair.
Article 5, Section 6 be incorporated into the A2 Amendment.
On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Now we need to return to Section, the A2 Amendment, which... Now, maybe I can have Ms. Pontius explain to me exactly at this point, because we have, I believe the A2 amendment is an amendment to Senate File 863.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members, then I think you've addressed, there's one section, the A2, that you haven't discussed. But.
Madam Chair.
Senator Moi.
Madam Chair, I wonder if Ms. Pontius, now that we've processed all the things that are in the 863 amendment, maybe on the A2 amendment, maybe Ms. Pontius can walk us through the whole document and then...
And perhaps we should address, though, the one technical, or there's something technical in Senate File 863 that we haven't talked about yet? No? I think there is.
Is there one more section that we haven't touched on? Is that Senator Foley's bill?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, Madam Chair, members. The only thing in here you haven't talked about is Article 1, Section 6, which is on page 5. This is the cyber data sharing.
Oh,
this was Senator Foley's bill that was laid over from the last hearing.
Well, Madam Chair and members, I had some concerns about this. I would move to strike Section 6 for the A2 amendment.
On that motion, all those in favor? Well, first, is there, sorry, any questions or discussion?
Why?
Well, Madam Chair and members, when we were having the discussion on the CYBRS program, my sense was that they, I was not convinced that they needed to move on this program. I felt that there were not sufficient policies and guidelines in place to guide how law enforcement would select which files to be uploaded into the database. It felt somewhat arbitrary, and I think that we need to have them give us an opportunity to, or have them come back to us with some more information on how they choose to put data, different sorts of data into the database. And I have some concern that without guidelines that would govern some uniformity in terms of different cases that are selected to be included in this database, and recognizing that this database is, in essence, being put together for the sole purpose of helping law enforcement to profile cases, and that the ability to upload information is at the discretion of the different law enforcement agencies without uniformity, I'm somewhat concerned about the arbitrary nature in which they will choose cases, and then I'm concerned about then the utility or the value or the usefulness of those databases if there aren't there's no uniform policy to guide what kind of cases gets uploaded.
So, Senator Moore, what I think I'm understanding you to say is that it isn't so much the language on its face you have a problem with in terms of those additional uses, but just the idea of expanding those uses when you have concerns about the underlying process and how that information is entered without sufficient guidelines to make sure that it isn't, that it's accurate and really representative and not being used in a potentially, say, discriminatory manner?
Yes.
Senator Betzel?
Well, Madam Chair, and if you look at the existing law, beginning on page 5, line 24, it's a statewide system containing data from law enforcement agencies. And the current law says it must be it's available to law enforcement agencies to prepare a case against a person, whether known or unknown, for commission of crime. Then also, we've dropped down to 5.34 for background investigation. So that's pretty limited. I hear what they're saying because they're saying, well, you know, the data's there, and there's a lot of uses we could use for that, serving, enforcing no contact orders and so forth. But I think, and I agree with Senator, I'd like to be a little bit more convinced because, frankly, you know, They could probably get anything in their database right now to cover any of these exceptions. They can say, well, you know, I have to serve criminal process. Give me the information. Whether, you know, how do you know? I mean, if that's the direction they really want us to go in, why don't they just say, make it all available to law enforcement for any reason? Because that's basically, you know, what you're doing here. And I'm not quite sure that I'm convinced that they've made that case yet, you know. I'm open to it, but I don't know if they've made it yet. So,
Senator Limmer?
Madam Chair, anyone who reads this, I think someone would question, what does CIBRS stand for anyway? It doesn't have a definition in this subdivision. But so there is a question of what is this thing that we're creating and what are we attempting to expand?
I cannot remember what the acronym stands for, but it's cybers is actually a defined term in this section of law.
But
well,
Madam,
somebody's
Madam Chair,
was
one,
actually
one
tell
other
you
thing.
What the
I,
acronym is.
Yeah.
But.
Senator Lemmer.
Here's the acronym.
It appears to be a rather significant step for data on citizens to be shared and seeking this type of authority. And being the ranking member of judiciary, I haven't had anyone lobby me on this. And so I'm kind of concerned about what are we really
well
deciding on, and it seems like it's a rather expansive approach. And
well,
I need more information before I would vote on something like this.
And Senator Lemmer, I think that Senator Moi has raised some issues that really have to do with the overall use of the system that probably are beyond the scope of our ability to address at this committee meeting tonight, but are a discussion it sounds like we're interested in having, so that once we're comfortable with those things, we can be comfortable with perhaps expanding the use as well. Senator Moi?
And Madam Chair, by stripping it from the omnibus bill, the data practice in omnibus bill, the bill still stays in the committee.
Sure.
There's opportunity for us to continue that discussion going forward, whether it's this session yet or over the interim and next session, which is the policy year. But it's a statewide system containing data from law enforcement agencies. And I was very specific in my line of questioning to the agency when they were here. And I said, well, what kind of data gets entered into this database by law enforcement agencies? And the response was, well, whatever files or cases we're working on that we think might be helpful to the database. Well, what do you determine to be helpful? Well, that could be used to profile other people later. I mean, I was not convinced that they were basing it on a specific set of criteria, but it was sort of like different agencies could have a whole bunch of cases going on. They can just say, oh, this one and this one and this one ought to be in the database. What value is a database that then's going to be used by other people for these type of purposes if the database is not significant?
Madam Chair?
Senator Lemmer?
All night tonight, we've been wrestling with different things where we make some data lists non-public, with the exception of giving that information to law enforcement. So in a way, we're doing the same thing, but piecemeal. And law enforcement is getting a wholesale list of citizens' activities or their licensure or whatever they have, and we're doing it piecemeal, and I don't know if you want to reconsider your votes, but we should be careful what we do when we do things piecemeal, because over time we're actually creating a more expansive list than what this cybers element is requiring us to consider. So data that's collected up in War Road might be able to be shared with a law enforcement agency in Worthington. And I'm not sure if that's
well, Senator Lemmer,
necessary.
I guess I would have to say that I think it is necessary for law enforcement to be able to share law enforcement data with each other and prosecute, in pursuing criminals. Or I'm thinking specifically of so many of the technologies that are being used now where criminals are often, operating in a multi-jurisdictional way where that's really important. So I don't think we want to tie law enforcement's hands unduly, but I do think it's important that we have some of these questions addressed, mm-hmm. making sure that there's uniformity in how the system is used. And I think that's the concern before we go forward and would make it more expansive. So it sounds like we have a couple of people here who would like to address this, but I have to say I don't know if we're going to solve this problem tonight, but we certainly want to give you an opportunity to speak. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Madam Chair and members, my name is David Johnson. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Justice Information Services. And this bill was requested, and these changes by the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Task Force, and then went through that process through the Juvenile and Criminal Justice Information Policy Group, which then forwarded it on for legislative consideration. First of all, to address a couple of the questions, Minnesota Statute 299C40 at the top of that statute identifies CYBRS as a comprehensive incident-based reporting system. So much is the case in any of the statutes as it moves on further, the acronym replaces it, just I'm sure for brevity. In regard to the data that is submitted to CYBRS, you all may recall that prior to the creation of CYBRS, data was being exchanged independently through by law enforcement agencies. And in fact, Minnesota statutes currently allow law enforcement agencies to exchange data between one another and puts no other regulation on that data other than what is otherwise included in the Data Practices Act. There were some issues surrounding some of the forms in which that data had been maintained outside of the purview of a statewide system, which led to a significant amount of discussion at the legislature, and the legislature created the CYBRS statute and the CYBRS system. And I know that I need to be brief, but there is a significant amount of regulation in regard to the use of CYBRS, the security of the data, where it can be shared, so forth and so on. It is important to understand that all of the data that is eventually submitted to CYBRS exists in a law enforcement database at the originating jurisdiction. It is not uniquely submitted into CYBRS. Again, the reason for this particular request is that, in fact, the legislature restricted the use and the sharing of the CYBRS data to law enforcement only and for two statutory purposes. It was hoped to expand those purposes, and that's what you see in front of you. There were, in fact, additional requests that were not did not make it through the scrutiny process of either the task force or the policy group. Again, all of the users of CYBRS have to be licensed. They have to take a test. It's in a secure network. They have to have a statutory reason for accessing it. It's fully auditable. And the purpose for which they are accessing has to be a component of getting the data out. And, in fact, the State of Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension audits those uses. It is true that an agency can choose to participate in sending the data to CYBRS or not to send data to CYBRS, to be a participating agency or not. Part of the problem with that goes back to discussions you all had prior to my coming to the State of Minnesota. But the fact is that there's a cost involved in that. To date, those contributing agencies, the interfaces, have been with grant funds that have been provided through the CRIMNET process. And the agencies that submit data do have the ability to select the cases that they are sending their information on. I have with me a list. In preparation, in case there was a discussion, I could not recite the 126 fields of data, and I have those with me today that is available. It takes a minimum of 6 fields, a maximum of 126. I can certainly leave it with the committee for your review. But again, all of the parameters that were involved in this system were vetted through the legislature, and this system was created under this statute. And so I think that's important to understand, that the ability to opt in or opt out is as a result of legislative directive. The ability to send records or not send records is a creation of legislative directive. And the fact of all of the various audit trails, the security, and so forth, are all of a concern in regard to the information that is contained in a centralized state database. And with that, I believe Superintendent O'Malley had a couple of comments he wanted to make.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. O'Malley. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the superintendent at the BCA. I'll be very, very brief. 3 quick points. It seems to me that most of the concerns that have been expressed by committee members are the reasons why CYBRS was created. As Mr. Johnson explained, years ago there was an exchange of information using technology that was not monitored and was not audited and was not, some would argue, even in compliance with the law.
And we went through a long process of going through the policy group and the task force and a number of legislators to ensure that this information would be secured and be accurate and so on. So the goal of cybers is to do exactly what is being professed here, I think. Secondly, this is just a communications tool. I could sit at my desk and call 87 sheriff's offices and ask them if you know Mary Smith because I'm trying to find her for an investigative purpose. Or I could look in cybers and compare that to see where there might be some information on her. So it's not a matter of whether law enforcement has this information. It's just a matter of how we can communicate it. And without this type of a database, public safety would be harmed. And then the last thing would be in practice, and I understand your concern, Senator, but in practice we're finding, or I think we will find as this continues to roll. We only had one agency in a year ago. Now we have 86?
97
today that are contributing data. Most of the agencies I've talked to have talked about their record management systems. Everybody's getting new systems of having a way that it just wholesale goes in there. Police officers don't have the time or the motivation, I don't think, to selectively pick those ones. That the idea is to have the information into a database so that it could be accessed by law enforcement only. That's all, ma'am.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. O'Malley, or Chief or Superintendent O'Malley, what kind of information would be accumulated in a database like this?
It's right here. Senator Limmer, it's here. We have the list.
Madam Chair and Senator, if you want Mr. Johnson to give you some examples of the types of case information that goes into this database, he could.
Senator Ma, is that the issue, or is Senator Limmer, is that your issue?
I'm not sure.
I guess I would have to say my issue, and I guess everyone will have to speak for themselves, but my issue isn't that you have a need for this or that it's a good idea or that regulating it is better than the way things were before. I think the valid concern that I heard raised is just to make sure that we're not selectively deciding how we're putting information in a way that would allow for targeting particular groups of people. And I don't think anyone's accusing anyone of saying they are doing that. It's just that we heard that the system, that there really aren't any criteria in place that would safeguard the system to make sure that the integrity of the information is valid and that the standards are uniform. And so since this is a new system, maybe that's a discussion that we should have to make sure that we do have those uniform standards. I guess that was the concern that I felt was that I had, and that seemed legitimate to me. Sarah Moy, did you?
Madam Chair, I appreciate Mr. Johnson and Superintendent O'Malley trying to answer the questions, but I think their answers underline some of the underlying concerns that I have, which is that now we're moving to a direction where we're wholesaling by departments, dumping information into one system. Superintendent O'Malley, is this database available to federal agencies?
Superintendent O'Malley or Mr. Johnson, if you know.
Madam Chair and Senator Wyatt, it is not. The beginning of the statute, and I've got it here someplace, the legislature specifically details who it's available to. It's available to Minnesota law enforcement agencies as detailed in the statute itself.
And, Madam Chair, Mr. Johnson, what about those quasi-Minnesota agencies that are also in partnership with other federal agencies? Because I see that there is a trending where we are creating cooperative enforcement agencies that are sort of quasi-federal, quasi-state, some state enforcement agents, you know, taking on some tasks that are federal agency-like. So are those individuals parsed from using this database?
Madam Chair, Senator Moy.
Mr. Johnson.
At the present time, subparagraph C, subdivision 1 of the statute defines a law enforcement agency that can access the system as a Minnesota Municipal Police Department Minnesota Transit Police, Metropolitan Airports Police, University of Minnesota Police Department, Department of Corrections Fugitive Apprehension Unit, Minnesota Sheriff's Department, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and the Minnesota State Patrol. If you're not a member of that particular law enforcement agency, you are not able to access the cyber system.
Sarah Betzel.
Madam Chair, you know, and a couple of years ago, I mean, it was determined, found out that, you know, some law enforcement agencies were without any authorization, you know, just collecting all kinds of information and sharing it. And that's what caused the problem in the first place. And as long as, you know, now this is authorized. This is an authorized database since the other one was not. As long as you're going to start creating a database, people are going to want access to it. And, you know, and I guess Mr. Johnson or Chief O'Malley or Superintendent O'Malley, I mean, there's some reasons in here. It seems to me, though, as I said earlier, at some point, you know, the exceptions are going to swallow the rule. And at some point, you know, if the goal is to have all law enforcement agencies contribute into the database, to be able to access the database, if that's the direction we're going in, why don't we just say that that's the direction we're you want to go in? I don't know if that's the way the legislature wants to go, but, you know, ultimately, isn't that where this is ultimately leading to?
Mr. O'Malley or Mr. Johnson?
Madam Chair and members, I'm not sure that's where it's going to lead to, Senator. I would say this, that when this first was created, the history that you cited is exactly right. And quite frankly, there needed to be some trust built up. And it was used exclusively for preparing a case, for a criminal case. And again, it isn't even necessarily, it's not the BCA. It went through this task force and others, which is law enforcement, public defenders, courts, prosecutors, the whole gambit of criminal justice. And they said, you know, if there's a public safety issue really here, like, criminal serving process in a criminal case, it's not preparing the case, but it's preparing for trial. Locating missing person, no contact orders. It seems to me that this would be a wise use of this database. And again, there were, I don't know how many others, five or six other exceptions they wanted, and there was a debate about that and said, no, that's going beyond what we think the scope should be at this point. I have an appreciation for the concerns on the debate of how this data could be used or selectively entered, but that's the same concern that was there, I guess, when the legislature debated it a few years ago, and these expand the use but don't necessarily change the rules.
Sarah Moore.
Madam Chair, it's getting late. I appreciate the Superintendent, Mr. Johnson, being here. I think the bill is in the committee, and we ought to have a broader, larger, full committee discussion on this issue. So I renew my motion to strip this from the A2 amendment, and we will bring the Department of Public Safety to come and have a conversation with full Judiciary Committee on the Cybers one, as well as MNJIS and the other database programs that they have.
And Madam Chair, and I,
Senator Betzel,
you know, I mean, all the bills start merging together in my head right now, and I mean, it's a lot of things are happening. I don't recall in the committee when Senator Foley presented the bill, were we told the recommendations that were not adopted? I mean, you've given us the ones that you wanted, but, you know, I think that'd be helpful to me because those are the ones that are coming up next. If we adopt these 2 or 3 years from now, then somebody's going to come on and say, well, let's expand it to something else. So at least I'd like to have some idea of, you know, what's on the horizon. So,
sounds like everyone wants to have more discussion about this issue than we really have the time to do right now. And so on Senator Moore's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Now, I think we're at the point to move the A2 amendment to Senate file
863.
So on the motion to adopt the A2 amendment to Senate file 863. All those in favor say aye.
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 As amended, yes.
Sensibly
amended. Yes. Opposed. Motion prevails. Now, I think the motion would be to recommend that Senate File 863 be recommended to pass and referred to the full Judiciary Committee as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, all of those of you who hung in there with us to this hour. And
meeting is adjourned.
Meeting is adjourned.